Good evening, everybody. This is Mumday Seminar 25. It's September the 26th and 7 p.m. in New York City. I guess we are coming to you live and you are coming to us, possibly dead. I guess that's the question is, when you're on air, you're a nobody. And if you're listening to this and recorded, what is this? A sort of kind of necrophilia? Who knows? Anyway, with us today is Bob. We've got Foo Fighter. There's Ginny. And there's a countless number of lurkers. So let's go.
Okay, just a second, Andrew. Okay, I want to continue emphasizing Coker, and I want to show some details of how to read his books.
Okay, so first of all, Bob, why are we emphasizing Coker?
I find his language, rereading Data Trash came out in 94, and then this week I read Spasm came out in 93, this is before people went online, and he's describing what happens to everybody. It's very prophetic, and it's way. And McLuhan did not address the Android meme of the 90s with any detail, and he does. So he's the only one following along on McLuhan's points, and doing a good job at it. And he has a whole language. It also helps to explain my chart. So. When you're reading Coker, either Spasm or Data Trash, you will see that he uses the phrase electronic body, and then another time telematic body, the virtual body, recombinant commodity, recombinant sign form. He uses these terms, and if you're reading, to really understand and match with what the meanings are, you're going to be confused. What's the electronic body? What's virtual reality? What's the telemetric body or the telematic body, and what's the virtual body? So reviewing it, I noticed that what he calls the electronic body is what I call the TV landscape. So thinking of what the media environment was in the 60s, 70s, and 80s before the internet came on and everybody had their personal computer and was emailing around, that is what Coker, the second phase, is the chip body, or the virtuality, or the virtual reality, or the virtual body, not the electronic body. Now, what's interesting, when you read it, he doesn't, reading Data Trash, he's not always exact in following what I'm saying. Sometimes where he should say electronic body, he says virtual body, and sometimes where he should say virtual body, he says electronic body. Now, that's totally appropriate for what he's trying to do, because he's trying to show the tactile interface between man and machine. Now, on my tiny note chart, I have the Coker quadrant. I have all the senses there, and then I say they're squared. And so it's the squaring of tactility that he includes in his writing, that the Android meme is the tactile environment extended, so I call it squaring it. Nobody works with tactility like Coker does and then deals with the extended tactility. And he refers to it by saying we're in a world of trompe-l'oeil or anamorphosis, sign sliding, ambiguity and ambivalence. These are terms where he is pointing out and creating an alibi of why he slips and slides between the electronic body, which 80% of the time is used in the sense I mean by the TV landscape, and the chip body refers to the chip landscape. He's using them accurately 80% of the time, but then he uses them in the wrong category. But that would be accurate if you want to show the fact that tactility is sliding over and across a dialectic, or what Coker calls a bimodern polarity. So this tactility, he actually writes correctly. It's like pinning his wake, putting in misspelled words. You have to do that to make people aware that there's more than just what your eyeball sees. So
he's not just talking about something; he's doing it. There's a mimetic dimension to his techno-poetics or something.
That's really good. Good point. He makes a big deal about how virtual reality leads to nothing but mimesis. So yes, he started off with Panic Encyclopedia that was written in the style of panic writing. He's admitting he's doing panic writing. And yeah, so he's miming the situation, which he says is all you can do, because the simulacrum and the virtual reality has taken us over, that you can't get outside of it. There's no a distancing situation. As a matter of fact, he talks about the ironic distancing versus the ironic immersion. It's always ironic. It's always a level of super awareness because the person is involved with a technical extension that has come alive. And he may not know how to articulate it, but you're living, dealing with a living technical environment that's come alive, and it puts the chemical body in a rather, you know, obsolete position or sideline. So, but the chemical body is forced to engage with it, so it engages and immerses in it, ironically, and tries to maintain some distance, ironically. So you'll see
okay,
in Coker's...
So McLuhan just so McLuhan first intuited that the technological extensions have come alive. Yes.
Yes, that is said in War and Peace. I don't have the exact page, but you could Google it and you'll see he says that in 1968 he's saying, and this would be written in 67, that what you have to realize is our technical extensions have become organic. Matter of fact, we used to have that quote on our Per McLuhan site and the McLuhan Institute site in the early 2001, 2002. Have you ever? Do you know that quote, Andrew?
Yeah. Where media have become the new animals, and
no, not that part. That's later. He says in the middle of the book that he makes the point. He says our technical, our electric environments have become organic, meaning alive.
Yep.
But he does not address that. Okay, I want now. Okay, so I'm going to show you two things to show today. They'll begin to show. Is the stages that Coker lays out, like the stages on my chart. You have the LaRouche quadrant, you have the McLuhan quadrant, the Thompson quadrant, the Coker quadrant, and the Dobbs quadrant. If I go to page 53 of Spasm, he says this. He says, anyway, you want to identify yourself?
This is Youngblood.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Youngblood. So we're talking about Coker, Youngblood. So Coker points out that his mentor, Jean Baudrillard, is a very good describer, explainer of the simulacrum or the simulation phase. But Coker enters the scene in the late 80s to say, no, we're past the simulation because the simulation has become alive. And he's saying that Baudrillard doesn't really address that level. So here are the categories from Marxist literature that Baudrillard and Coker work with, because that's their background. They're leftists. And here's how Coker updates it. And you can map this onto my chart. But first of all, here's how he lays it out. So he's talking about Baudrillard, and then Coker says, anyway, we are already living beyond simulation. In brackets, where the model generates reality. So in the Baudrillard phase, which we can call the TV landscape, because the central nervous system has been extended, and the word makes the market, what television does becomes the new nature. And Baudrillard said that's the model superseding reality by generating reality or new nature. So that phase is called simulation. And Coker says we are already living beyond simulation, in brackets, where the model generates reality. In a more spastic experience, then he says, the society of the waveform, that's what he's calling it, the more spastic experience is the society of the waveform. And then in brackets, where the model vanishes into the recombinant language of data genomes. Now what Coker is saying is that the biology has merged with the technology. So our chemical bodies, but it's actually our genes that leave our chemical body, leave behind human beings, and merge with data or the simulation or the virtual reality. So he's going to emphasize the genetic nature. The genes have left us, but that's coming down in a few minutes. So I'm just getting these levels. So he says the society of the waveform where the model vanishes into the recombinant language of data genomes. Then he says, sampling, therefore, and he makes a big deal out of sampling is the way you mime the present. Sampling, therefore, beyond alienation, in brackets, that's an old leftist term, which seeks to preserve the order of the real. So look at the LaRouche quadrant, 1840 to 1900, the time of Marx, crystallized in 1960 as a replay. They're trying to preserve the order of the real. That's why I titled that section, that quadrant, God. that leads the literate extension of trying to establish a reality that literacy brings in, that leads to humans being alienated. So Coker's saying we've moved beyond alienation, which seeks to preserve the order of the real, and we're beyond reification, which is the next phase in Marxist thinking, inaugurated, brought in by Georges Lukács. So what is reification? We're now moving beyond the Lewis quadrant towards the McLuhan quadrant. In brackets, reification privileges the stability of the ruling concepts. So that's where the concepts about the model are taking over. So we've gone beyond alienation, beyond reification, and Coker's using these terms because he's talking to a Marxist audience. And then he says, and beyond simulation, in brackets, where the concept is the real itself. So you've got alienation, which seeks to preserve the order of the real, reification, which privileges the stability of the ruling concepts. That would be the word that makes a market. That's the McLuhan era. And then beyond simulation, where the concept is the real itself, that might get into the Thompson and Coker quadrant. Let's just say the Thompson quadrant, where it's a computerized global theater. Then Coker attempts to explain where we are. So we're moving into the Coker quadrant when he says, this is where we're at. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Okay? That should make you laugh, but that's...
You know, it's terrifying, Bob. You're laying out like this, in one sense, this absolute horrendous post-apocalyptic zone. I'm not pro-Photoshop.
You know what?
I'm not all for Photoshop. I'm not part of the pro-Photoshop mentality.
That you're speaking personally?
Yeah, this is just a personal observation. So this is just my visceral reaction to the situation.
Well, this is what Croker. I mean, this is what Croker had to do to get past Baudrillard. He's almost on.
Horrendous.
Beg your pardon?
Post-apocalyptic, just absolutely horrendous.
That's right. Okay, if you actually take it seriously. So the paragraph. Now, I'm going to just run this through. You're not meant to get it, but he just laid out that paragraph where he went from alienation to reification to simulation to then a culture of quantum fluctuations, where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Now, that's another way of saying what is said on my album, Everything's Disappeared. So everything's disappeared. So you can't experience anything. That's virtual reality. That's the level that Coker is writing.
Last week, Ion said there is no communication.
Right. This is a world of no communication. So then here is, this section that I'm quoting from is called Improved Hearing. So he follows up with that paragraph saying, the pre-digital ear is the first victim of sound trompe-l'oeil, from the virtual sound of Madonna Mutant to the virtual body of Michael Jackson. So then, an urgent requirement emerges to speed up the ear to match the oral velocity of digital reality, to pump up the genetics of hearing to equal the sounds of the datascape. Sampling technology, therefore, as a filter for mutant eardrums. Then he has a colon. Then he lists off some of the aspects of mutant eardrums. Looped ears, partitioned hearing, panned sound, that's P-A-N-N-E-D, panned sound, accelerated eardrums, time-stretched sound, digit-design ears. Then Coker says, in the materiality of sampling, we can discover anew a language for rethinking a universe that has been blasted apart by digital technology. Consequently, the education of a cynical ear can be an aesthetic strategy for learning how to cohabit the planet with Android processors. Now think of this in relation to McLuhan's talking about visual and acoustic space. You know what I mean? This is hyper analogy. Bring Mark Solomon in. Where's the analogy here, Andrew? Is there an analogy going on here?
Yeah, but it's analogy squared and cancelled and retrieved and flipped all in one sentence.
Right. Now we go to page 154, and I found another section where Croker's running through the phases and trying to bring you up to post-Baudrillard. So he says, he does this whole description of what Baudrillard is talking about. I'll just read that paragraph a little bit. No longer a politics of sacrificial violence, but something much more ominous, a politics of cynical sacrifice, where knowing that there is no longer any substantive aim to sacrifice, that the gods of mimesis are finally dead, there's mimesis in italics, Still, like Nietzsche's nihilist before us, we would prefer to go on sacrificing rather than not to act at all. So then, suicidal sacrifice of our bodies, culture, and politics as a certain sign that we are living now in the days of the death of ritual and the radical disenchantment of the horizon of signs. So he's trying to point to the devastating reality of virtual data as opposed to the more timid era of simulation that Baudrillard and McLuhan are experts on. So then he says all that, then he goes, or maybe it's something completely different. If we can experience so vividly the politics of cynical sacrifice, perhaps that is because we have already moved at warp speed into another history, into another geography of culture, beyond the age of the sign to virtuality, beyond simulation to recombinant culture, beyond the era of the merely technological to the era of biotechnology. So the era of merely technological would be the McLuhan, the LaRouche and McLuhan quadrants. You start to get into virtuality with the Thompson and the Croker. You get fully into it with the Croker quadrant. So to go from the age of the sign to virtuality, that's the age of McLuhan to Croker. Beyond simulation, that's beyond Baudrillard, to recombinant culture. Recombinant culture is the genetics, the genes merging with technology, and he calls that biotechnology. And it's beyond the merely technological. So we're beyond communication and we're beyond technology. That is why mediacology as a discipline has been acceptable in universities since the 90s and it's brought back McLuhan a little bit. Because now that technology or media is obsolete, the academics can go and putt around in it and write papers on it. But Croker was the only academic to deal with the present. And that's why Croker would not attend any mediacology conferences. That was the obsolete situation. That's the rearview mirror. So then he says, in this case, the twin politics of viral purity and cynical sacrifice can drench the world with their ferocity because they are already a maison scene, which means, he says, a fatal sign of that which has existence now only as a faded reminder of a previous stage of political history. All right, so that's another attempt to show these stages of alienation, ramification, simulation, and then virtuality. So we're not including communication virtuality, and we're not including technology in the virtuality phase. Now, here's where McLuhan gets real close to Croker. He did say in a panel, I heard this on CBC, something was going on their ideas show in 1970, and a psychiatrist comes on, and he says, I was at a symposium with Marshall McLuhan, and he was disgusting. He said the goal today is not to communicate. And the psychiatrist who's into the therapeutic, it's just starting to become a therapeutic society in the 70s. And the psychiatrists are going to have a great heyday, especially when they get into their Prozacs and stuff. And they claim that they're communicating to the patient, right, and helping the patient to communicate. And so McLuhan, being an outsider, manipulative satirist, just bypasses all these experts. Says the whole goal now is not to communicate. Now, that's pretty radical to say that in 1970, right when the boomers and everybody else is in a panic state, claiming we need better communication so we can get out of this Vietnam quagmire, right? I mean, to come into that and say the goal is not to communicate. Now, McLuhan could mean that turn off the television environment. Yeah, that's the communicating meme. Turn it off. That may be one level he means, right, Andrew? Would you agree with that?
Sure. Communication fundamentally meaning transformation, and so to stand back from being transformed, to get a bit of stasis and turning off would be the way to go.
Yeah, the goal is not to communicate. He means communication as transformation.
Yep, less transformation, yeah. At least for a little while.
Yes. Okay. So, and you know, it's in it. McLuhan's on a panel. He says that. People are shocked. They don't ask him what he means. And so the psychiatrist goes on the media and complains about it and never has a clue that McLuhan is not a wild, loose idiot. He actually has some things to say if you responded to the idea. Say, what do you mean by no communication? And he would have explained mediacology. So, but, you know, everybody's already in a panic state of communication and just trying to get their own view out there in the media so they can get their grants or funding. Right? You get that point, Andrew?
Yeah.
McLuhan's commenting on there's no actual communication in the university environment where they're supposed to be teaching kids communication.
this is completely the ground now in Twitter, Bob.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak today, and thank you to Mary Bryson for the kind invitation, and it's great to be presenting with Suzanne. So let me just get into it. I'm going to speak today about the miseducated imagination of Marshall McLuhan. And
this is Arthur Croker.
Northrop Frye, Canada's foremost cultural critic, literary critic, has written evocatively about the educated imagination is the essence of creative human culture. For Frye, the contemporary historical project is distinguished in all of his texts by a fatal struggle between the power of technological materialization and the equally powerful will to human creativity, with the educated imagination itself for Frye as a way of ensuring, sitting sort of as an in-between, as a way of assuring the endurance of the human condition in all of its singularities and paradoxes and incommensurabilities. Now, in contrast to Northrop Frye, his vision of the educated imagination, Michel Foucault has argued in his lectures at the Collège Philosophique de France on the topic of society must be defended, that beginning with the death of the amateur scholar in the 18th century, education itself has increasingly been borne along in the ways of normativity and hierarchy and rule by specialists. And indeed, real intellectual violence in the name of the increasingly sequestered professional imagination. When the future of the imagination itself is at stake in the games of modernity, the fulfillment of Frye's dream for the educated imagination depends, I believe, ironically, on new strategies and tactics for the proliferation of what I would call the miseducated imagination, indispensable for critical, creative, and in-depth understanding of the real world of the digital culture.
Excellent, Ion. Very good.
Yeah.
Now, is it that one? There is this, Croker's talking about, and there's another thing on YouTube where he's talking about what McLuhan contributed and then how it had flipped since McLuhan. Have you seen that, Andrew? That Croker YouTube is one of the rare ones. But
no, I don't think I have.
Yeah, it's good. So maybe if Ion can bring that up, you're welcome to bring it anytime. But so people, that was Croker talking about Northrop Frye, the environment to McLuhan. There was two major Canadian thinkers in literary matters, Northrop Frye and Marshall McLuhan. So Ion just played Croker describing the background to Northrop Frye's theme of the modern syndrome of the miseducated imagination. Now, Croker's going to go on and show the limitations of Frye, and then how McLuhan handled it better. All right.
Bob,
so, go ahead.
Bob, could I ask a question, Bob? Can you know the kids protesting on Wall Street?
Yeah.
Can you talk about how Marshall McLuhan would describe that versus how Croker would describe it? Because, you know, we kind of see these people there kind of shouting at blank walls, and Wall Street's really like a huge digital, worldwide, you know, financial network. It's not the people. So would that be helpful to talk how one guy looks at it versus the other?
Okay,
guy?
Let me finish the Croker introduction, then we'll go to that. That's getting to the today. We're trying to do some background, and my agenda is to show the relevance of Croker in the MUM. You may not have heard last week. We went from McLuhan on Maui. It's now McLuhan under Maui. We're burying McLuhan, and we can bury him best through Croker. And as Andrew ended the session last week, we're groping for a new language that we can use. And we can't use McLuhan's language. We need to understand McLuhan. Then we have to see how McLuhan's whole reality came true, and it was squared. And Croker's very good at analyzing the squared version of McLuhan's simulated vision. So I'm always going to be introducing and bringing quotes, and then I want to take these phases and show it to my chart and then something else. So here on page 157, I just read you 154 about virtuality, simulation, merely technological through the era of biotechnology. Then on page 157, he repeats these stages. He says, a digital history where labor is fast sequenced, and then these kids in Wall Street want a new structure for jobs and labor, the ones you were just talking about, Hugh. A digital history where labor is fast sequenced beyond the age of alienation, in brackets, Karl Marx. So Marx talked about alienation. That's 19th century issues during the printing press and the newspaper and the telegraph. Beyond reification, in brackets, George Lukacs. That's the early part of the 20th century, getting into the radio era, movie era, TV era. No, maybe not TV era. because the next phase is beyond simulation. And he puts in brackets the old 20th century Baudrillard, and he could also say McLuhan. So that's past Lukacs. So let's call that simulation is the mixture of TV and computers and satellites, or just TV, because the transition to virtual reality involves computers, but they're shrinking computers and more compressed, and they're not the mainframe computers of the 1560s. It's the digital, what I call holopathic computers. That may be more the level that Croker's talking about as the, with the word virtuality, not the previous stage of simulation. So it's a strange shift from, it's a nebulous shift from simulation to virtuality. But it's definitely knowable by citizens by 1996 when they're all on the computer and emailing. That's when people started to think that McLuhan was on something. Look at these media. They're changing my whole social life the way I am. It was such a blatant change, such a blatant transformation, anybody could notice it. But the point was that they didn't see that actually chemical bodies were not being changed. They didn't know that virtuality was just talking among itself. And that's the level that I talk about and Croker talks about. So he says, this digital history of labor is fast sequenced beyond the age of alienation, beyond reification, beyond simulation, becoming a floating sign. So this is what labor is. It's a floating sign in an endless metastasis of exchange value. In this case, we could finally speak of virtual labor, of labor value that has no value except as a sign of that which never was. So now I want to apply. We can go back to these phases, and they overlap with my chart, the LaRouche quadrant, alienation, McLuhan, simulation, the virtuality, the Croker-Thompson into the Croker quadrant. And so then you have the shrinking of these quadrants so that the TV landscape becomes a TV body and the chip landscape becomes a chip body. You'll see in reading Croker, he's always talking about how the virtual space is growing bodies. So my use of these five body terms are within the language of Croker. But now I want to show you a practical use, how Croker applies his categories to a new technology in the late 80s, early 90s. And you will see it is way beyond what McLuhan writes. So Croker looks at the television environment, and by the early 90s, he's calling it excremental TV. And there is four aspects of excremental TV. And you'll see these on my at the top of my tiny note chart. Sacrificial TV, disciplinary TV, surveillance TV, and crash TV. Now, I'm going to take the surveillance TV and read this section, and you will hurt when you hear this. Now, listen to this. Surveillance TV. This is the world of the camcorder, okay? People going around with their little video cameras in the late 80s, early 90s, where Marx's priest, and priest is in quotes, finally comes inside the televisual subject, so that would be the TV body, and so this is the beginning of the chip body swallowing up the TV body. Finally comes inside the televisual subject. You want to identify yourself?
Barbara.
Oh, great. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, how you doing?
Just want to tell you, okay, we'll talk about that later. I have something to tell you privately after. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so reading Croker, and we're discussing the camcorder. This is the world of the camcorder where Karl Marx's priest kind of person finally comes inside the televisual subject like a cancerous tumor, and everybody becomes their own surveillance camera. So he's talking about what happens to the population when they got the little camcorders. Then he says, note, for example, the global witnessing of the Rodney King beating, which was about 91, 92, with its twofold message of explicit police brutality and an implicit, repeated televisual warning to African Americans that they have good reason to fear encounters with the security state. So there's two messages of the Rodney King temporary word that made the market. At other times, surveillance of the previously undocumented regions of the self, self in quotes, as the camcorder zooms in on the catastrophe zone of the excremental family. Now, all you people got families, so we're going to hear a very hurtful description of what you grew up in and then what the camcorder does it. At other times, just repeating that, surveillance of the previously undocumented regions of the self. In other words, Rodney King showed what cops were doing that most people had never seen before. And then now Coker's applying it to the family. We're seeing the growth of children in the family that's being recorded on a camcorder. Did someone just come in and want to say who they are? Okay. Ian. Ian, who's interested in ION, that Ian?
I'm interested.
Speak clearly, man. Come on, you got this low volume. Who are you and what are you?
I'm only a student. I'm in Columbus, Ohio. And
Okay, good. You're in Ohio. You're probably bouncing in and out. Okay, here we go. So, this self, the undocumented parts of yourself when you grew up in the family are able to be taped on the camcorder. So here's what Coker lists off. See Johnny's first birthday. See Johnny's first masturbation. See Johnny's first toilet training. Now he's going to talk about the effects of this. Here the camcorder is the privileged televisual medium of experimental culture. Less about documentalism, although that too, it is really a viral weapon in the eatable struggle. That point where the unhappy union of daddy, mummy, me, that's hyphenated, daddy, mummy, me, is turned into a surveillance zone for future punishment, colon. Mummy's camcorder invasion of the privacy of her children, and daddy stores up televisual images for future ridicule. Then he says, in surveillance TV, the optical power of the camera finally leaves the static, centralized region of the TV studio and becomes something fluid, polymorphous, and immensely popular. The camcorder, then, is the newest member of the televisual family. Every mummy becomes an archivist of the moving image of family history. Every daddy, a potential film director, editing and re-editing the script of the family story with its jump cuts, montage techniques, and Godardian reversals. And every little me, an unlicensed actor in the unfolding logistics of perception into which the excremental family has happily disappeared. New paragraph. Panic families, therefore, where the will to visually record family life is in direct relation to the breakdown of unitary family relations. When the family dissolves into a lap frame of TV life, the cinematic screen finally goes liquid and actually enters the body. Life becomes an eternal TV game show, an optical trompe-l'oeil, a perfect scene of cinematic derealization with 1,000 hours of camcorder childhood memories, with this endless stockpiling of dead images which no one will ever look at, because they are really about the erasure of experience, the extermination of memory. So Coker's saying this whole camcorder situation, documenting the life of the kid, is actually exterminating real memory. I'm just moving over to the windows because the noise, Monday noise guys are coming in.
The eco-fascists are here at the window.
Yeah, the eco-fascists, right on schedule. They're what McLuhan called hebdomadal. That means every seventh day they show up and ruin our seminars here. So now I have to find the part in the book I was at. The wind blew it away. Excremental.
Camcorder's role in the extermination of memory or the erasure of memory.
Right. Now, another paragraph. I hope this is not too long, but it's really, are you beginning to notice the deadly x-ray that McLuhan's making here? And he says, and what about the future of the children of the camcorder generation, that televisual generation of whom it might be said, quote, this is your life? Or is it? You know, question mark. Not this is your life. This is your life? Or is it? Unquote. That's what you say about these kids who are being camcorded. So Coker goes on. Perhaps for them, a new technological advance in the age of digital TV will emerge with the appearance on the market of the video interceptor. The interceptor, a new technology for digitally resequencing all the debris of family memories. Here, daddy can be made to play on the floor in the role of the baby. Mommy can be cloned. Brothers and sisters can be added at will. And all the visual materials of the family album that were on the digital camcorder can be digitally reordered. When all the children are like the aliens in Blade Runner, with their useless stockpiling of virtual memories, then every child will be free to play the game of staged communications to its final point of disappearance, that cinematic moment when the camcorder finally becomes a way of doing philosophy, a visually recoding all the nostalgic memories of the eatable family. And why not, says Coker, the generation of cam children, in quotes cam children, has been robbed of its memories by its forced enclosure in the family script, actually given the wrong televised memories by the cinematic realization of its parents. These never were their memories, but the false images of their parents, a kind of televisual prison for the future of the virtual child, where even the ability at maturity to reflect on the past of family life has already been scripted in advance. So then, for the future camcorder generation, the direction of political rebellion is clear. Discover the inner camcorder. The camcorder that has been suppressed by the disappearance of subjectivity into the distended eye of the eatable family. Fight surveillance TV by going vague, by using the video interceptor to cross the stock footage of the old camcorder family to digitally resequence memories of family life until the desired digital family finally emerges. Isn't that incredible?
Oh, it's beautiful. I just can't wait until some psychologist offers some little in-class sessions where the inner child is replaced by getting in touch with your inner camcorder.
So that's a beautiful description. That's Croker. Like, McLuhan would go into details about the particular effects of movies or TV or the tape recorder. And he'd go across the culture and do an inventory. I don't see McLuhan dealing with the camcorder like this. I mean, McLuhan has a family. He's a Catholic. He's working within certain bourgeois terms. Croker, being an anarchist, Croker himself never had any children, I don't think. He ain't any nostalgic guy for family. He rips apart the whole family in the tradition of the Frankfurt School and Theodore Adorno as a bourgeois institution. But look how he sees that he's up against an android meme family and the duped parents, agents of the android meme, killing their kids' memory by making pre-scripted memories.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Andrew, someone else wants to speak. Go ahead.
Say, does that really do that, though? I mean, because each individual, like I came from a family of five, I had two siblings, and we each have kind of different memories. We remember different things, but we were never. Actually, we were only camcorded once, I think, a couple times. But my parents didn't really do that.
Yeah, I think you're older. You're before.
Yeah.
You weren't 4 years old in 90.
Right.
Right. See, but you right at the beginning of it.
Okay,
and this is going on, you know, by the 90s, everybody's taping everything. And so those kids are now in college. What do they have to say? And I like the way Croker predicts that they should go vague. Now, don't they? I know that over by 10 years ago, the sociologists were complaining that the post Generation X, so Generation Y, had really good data mining skills and working with the internet and all that, or their laptops, but they were vague socially. Do you ever remember that being said, Andrew? They had no social skills.
Yes.
No normal chemical body interactivity skills. Well, it looks like Croker predicted it 20 years ago and told them to go vague.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. That's very prophetic. And he could claim that, you know, what sociologists complained about 10 years ago, they just took his advice. When you're being documented, your chemical body is being, you know, your first masturbation, your first adultery is all being filmed. You have to start deny chemical body precision and emphasize your chip body, the vague, non-visual, tactile situation. And the kids, when they started mumbling and not talking clearly, whether they knew it or not, they were going into a reaction formation or a defense mechanism or a strategy to psychically survive.
Hey, it's Richard Bipple. How's it going?
Very good. Were you camcorder when you were a kid?
No, I was a little later, but I think the reason why they're mumbling.
A little later? Wait. What's
like
later?
Like everybody. I wasn't as a kid. No, definitely not as a kid.
Because you're older?
Yeah, it was Super 8, if that.
Okay, so do you have any experience you can tell us about younger kids who were camcorded?
Well, there was a movie genre that got mentioned like 8 years ago called mumblecore, like mumbling, and then they added core at the end of it.
Okay.
And I think what you're saying, what Croker was saying, is that they were unconsciously reacting to that capture state of being in a constant surveillance state to create a defined vagueness, so there would be less ability to understand the document, which was really their parents' arbitrary point of view of what aren't their own personal memories.
the Oedipal struggle, the kid's going to make a new identity. He's got a very complex situation, you know, with several bodies going on about how he's going to assert himself to be different from his parents.
Yeah. And, yes. and how they're like, oh, this is your third birthday. It's like, it's your perspective of my third birthday based on the limitations of the extension of your understanding of the camera that you're holding. That's what it is. It's not my third birthday, but
yeah.
It's something. It's not what you're saying it is, but thank you. It's
right.
Like, in a lot of ways, it's like we were saying, or you were saying last week with Andrew, that McLuhan didn't have the vernacular, or the words weren't available, the language of the technology wasn't available, but I was thinking that's kind of like what he was talking about with Edgar Allan Poe, leaving out the clues to do what we're doing now, which is filling in the blanks and engaging with the insight and still maintaining the mystery, which Thiel was always trying to...
No, you're going you go on too much, Bipple. You were starting to make a good point. Which I forgot, but let me try to remember. It was back at the beginning. Yeah, McLuhan talked about media when people didn't know the word media. So he made a poetics out of the word media. Then you have to see that what I'm reading was written in 1991 when Mondo 2000, which was called a title before that, A High Reality. When Mondo 2000 comes out, in 1991 is when Jaron Lanier... got written up on the New York Times.
Virtual
And people wanted to get virtual helmets. And so that was the thing. You went around to some convention and you put a virtual helmet on. And that was virtual reality. Only the McLuhanites knew that we'd been in virtual reality for 100 years, you know, under electric conditions. Croker knew that. Croker took the new phenomenon, virtual reality, and right that year, he took that new term, the new fad word, virtual reality, and he makes a whole manifesto out of it. That's working fast. That's knowing the present and writing a detailed history of what the implication of the virtual reality helmet was right away. And McLuhan did that with the word media. So that's the point here. He took the new word, virtual reality, which was not a word, not a fad in McLuhan's time. He was gone.
Exactly.
So Croker took the new word and immediately, you know, waxed eloquent. And that's active living in the present. So that's the method of McLuhan, but done with new language. There's another point there. He's criticizing the faddishness that Mondo 2000 magazine will create. It was the big magazine in 91-92, put out by Are You Serious in San Francisco and Queen Moo. And the antidote to that was Wired magazine.
Right.
Mondo 2000 was told by Tim Leary that Wired was propped up by the CIA to counter the effect of Mondo 2000. Now, it may or may not have been true, but definitely Wired was more industry-oriented than the Mondo 2000. Now, Are You Serious? He eventually joins Arthur Croker's board of C-Theory, and there's an interview with Are You Serious? And it's like Croker let him be a member of the board of Crokerland, to be on the board, because he confessed. Are You Serious says in this interview with Croker that when they started Mondo 2000, they were fooled by this new virtual reality. They thought it was going to be a glorious new environment. They were not looking at the disservices of it. And they got swept away and celebrated it for a few years. Then they started to notice that, probably with Netscape, that it went on to a level way beyond what they were doing. Anybody and his dog was there on the Internet. It went beyond the image of Stuart Brand and the guys at the wellness site, the original billboard,
right,
which Are You Serious and them were part of. He realized that the disservices of the virtual reality is what he would rather have concentrated on rather than the celebration of it. So he defects to Croker and shakes Croker's hand for having written the stuff the same time that they were celebrating virtual reality in their magazine. So it's an interesting relationship between that.
He also wrote for Wired. He did an article about postmodernism for Wired.
Who did? Who did?
Are you Serious?
Yeah, once he defected, once they stopped Mondo 2000, he then had to go individual, autonomous, virtual and start making a living. And he actually put a book out. He got a book made of his emails from his digital bunker about the effect of being well-known through the magazine. And then he started trying to be a journalist. And he has an internet radio show you can go to.
I think I heard one episode of that.
But basically, he was a San Francisco hippie, nostalgic for the hippie, and he thought that the digital culture would bring that bohemian aspect and psychedelic bohemia back, and it went way beyond what he thought. So he's still just back there on his internet show interviewing old hippies, and part of that meme. He never totally changed himself.
But isn't that what all people, like, even, you know, what's going on with, like, you know, the Twitter flash mobs in Egypt? I mean, they all think there's going to be some utopia, but ultimately it's just like, you know what? You're going to become exactly what you're criticizing.
That's right. Now let me give you an example. I want to show you.
Energy created by our media present us with possibilities of evasion or destruction.
That's from McLuhan's Wake.
Effects and this huge vortex of energy that in which we're involved. It may be possible to
turn it off.
Program a strategy of evasion and survival.
Cut.
This is Ion's doing this.
Yeah, it's McLuhan's Wake.
He said, "The laws of media."
Laurie Anderson.
Come in hope. But they only work as questions. What will you gain? What will you lose? What will return from an ancient time? And what will come of this thing you create if you let it go too far? There's no order to the laws of media. All these effects are happening all the time. The trick is to recognize the pattern before it is complete.
Kierkegaard is a man of great relevance for this time. Man of the inner trip, the inner dialogue, the inner encounter. He has a wonderful quote. Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived forwards.
Okay, very good, Ion. That was from, as Bipple pointed out, from the documentary on McLuhan called McLuhan's Wake. Now, you heard Laurie Anderson is one of the vocal speakers on that documentary, and she's got this romantic or pastoral vision there about pattern recognition. And then McLuhan comes on and talks about Kierkegaard, and I like that quote because that was one of the first points Ion made when he first showed up 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. He talked about, if you want to know what you're doing, imagine yourself as dying and then look back over your life. That seems to be what Kierkegaard said. What did he say?
Life can only be lived backwards, but you have to exist forwards or something.
Yeah,
like that.
You can only get, you only got retrospect. But Ion says to make that retrospect valid or, you know, poignant, do it from the point of dying. Okay, so anyways, now take those quotes from McLuhan, even that Heidegger, Kierkegaard quote. Now, here's Croker. Here's what Croker would tell the Egyptians in the Middle East, the Tunisians, these guys who were trying to get a new reality over there, a new economy, a new something, a new society.
Yeah.
Here's what they're heading towards. Crash TV. So you Egyptians, the inertial tendencies at the disappearing center of experimental TV, of experimental Egyptian TV, are overcome by the principle of re-energization through violence. On American college campuses, the most popular underground video these days is death video. Actual death scenes ranging from penal executions to corpses pulled from car wrecks. It's the same on television, where the newest hit shows have to do with America's biggest crashes. And the name of the show in brackets is Eyewitness Video. Or for that matter, the network news, where the screen is energized again and again by all the passing scenes from splatter culture, in brackets, starvation victims, body fragments, to plane crashes, in brackets, human debris, from all the big catastrophes. So Hitchcock are telling the Egyptians this is what they want. You're going to get to crash TV. The metaphor of the screen can be energized by the metonymy of the catastrophic event because the ruling rhetoric of excremental culture is cynical seduction. The crossing of the syntagm, S-Y-N-T-A-G-M, between metaphor and metonymy, between rhetoric and catastrophe, a quick reversal that assures the fading attention of televisual subjects. Like a stellar blast from the darkest regions of outer space, Crash TV radiates the dark mass of the population, the dark mass of the Egyptians, Tunisians, and Saudis, with the ferocity of its explosion, as much as it fascinates with the primitivism of its imagery. In Crash TV, we suddenly exit modernist culture, the democracy, I would say, the democracy they're trying to get, and enter the unknown terrain of the postmodern primitive, that territory where all the postmodern technologies involved in the virtualization of the flesh merge with the most primitive of human emotions. So he then has a list. Fascination with the smoking wreckage of the crash, chilled paralysis at the sight of the catastrophe, one last joke as the plane falls through the air in its death spiral. And he ends saying, in the world of the postmodern primitive, what fascinates is not coherency or the accumulative logic of the stabilized image, but the ripping sound made when the walls of virtual reality implode under the fantastic pressure of surrounding events, and we are suddenly swept away in a catastrophic freefall through all the surrounding space. Splatter culture, Mr. Egyptian, is the final destiny and fatal dream inspiring the viral growth of Crash TV. Who hasn't said that in the Egyptian Parliament?
Yeah, it's delicious. So
it's good.
Would you put Croker in terms of in the position of the paramoderns insofar as he's bashing the modernists and postmodernists together and is pointing over the horizon?
No, he's bimodern. And the bimodern means dealing with modernism and its erasure and postmodernism and its obsolescence by technology coming alive, though some think that is the postmodern. So he's in between, in the corpus callosum between the modern and the postmodern and the post-postmodern, and he calls it bimodern. The paramodern is the Dobbs quadrant, where it does stuff by allow ion, the non-physical, to play in the chip body. That Croker won't do, I assume. We haven't introduced ion to him. We don't know if he could take it. But the paramodern works the whole span of my chart, works the LaRouche quadrant, the Thompson, the Croker, and McLuhan quadrant, and the Dobbs quadrant, and moves into the hexadic, which is the cold fusion and new breakthroughs, and then into the octet. So that's paramodern, and Croker doesn't get that far.
So, yeah, it's that complete, whatever you want to call it, but a comprehensiveness.
Well, it's
at the
new.
Very least.
Croker is an expert in analyzing the chip body. He's the poet of the chip body. He describes in these books before the chip body shows up. I mean, this is written before people had their personal computers.
Right, right.
You know, he's describing what's going to happen from 95 to 2011. I mean, when I met James Martinez, you know, the co-host on Cashflow,
yeah, of course,
in 2002. He was living, he was a casting person in Hollywood, living among the actors, and he called me up because Walter Bower said he should talk to me, and he started telling me about the disservice that the cell phone was doing to the whole Hollywood scene. And so I had, you know, serendipitously, a person reporting in when the effects of the cell phone in Los Angeles. And our conversations never left that point, is that James has watched the very things that Croker's talking about, which was very extreme, you know, in 91, 92, the excremental TV culture, James has more and more seen the excremental digital culture that happened to L.A. to the point that if you're an actor and you go and take classes, you're not going to get a job. You've got to kill your mother. You got to do something ridiculous to get on the TV space to even get a chance to get a gig in a movie or into a commercial. And so that all that James was a witness to in L.A. Is what Croker predicts. 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Now, that's pretty good. That's the same as what McLuhan say. They say McLuhan predicted the Internet. But it's timid what he predicted. Nothing like this. So he's the poet laureate of the chip body. And
symbolist in the extreme.
Right, or post-symbolist, parasymbolist. He plays off metonymy, which is a grammatical term, and metaphor, and the syntagm in between. The point is that that's the chip body. What Dobbs was doing was evoking the mystery body. And the mystery body merges, subsumes the other four bodies, and has moved into a whole new thing, so that Croker's descriptions do not apply. If you go to C-theory, you can read all kinds of essays, because he's an institution now, and a lot of students write essays and get them posted there, so they get their marks in wherever universities are around the world. They get their academic points by being on a peer-reviewed journal of the C-theory. But it is watered-down bastardization, like a lot of the McLuhanites we see speaking this year, of the purity of what Croker's original writings, which covered the whole ground. There was nothing more to add other than Croker. Just the deal was to understand it. And just like there was nothing to add to McLuhan in his phase, he had it all wrapped up. So you go to C-theory, you're not going to... What is Croker going to do when he finds out that we had non-physical posting quotes from his YouTubes on this show right now, on this seminar? You know, what's he going to think that is? Oh, that's JW. He goes to the computer and puts it... No, it ain't JW. It is a mystery landscape performing here. The chip body is a place that the mystery landscape can play in. So that's the side part. That's where we hope to move in a while, move the McLuhan seminars to Ion bringing in McLuhan or doing something and adding to this. But he's already performing a useful role by playing these a useful role by supplementing what we're doing here. That probably would not happen on C-theory. It's too academic.
Yeah, no, exactly. They need endorsed formality to even contemplate expression.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in Data Trash, and here and there, Croker criticizes what he calls the New Age. And he is correct what he says. In the words of the meme of the New Age that Marion Williamson, Deepak Chopra, Shirley MacLaine, that general popularization out there where people run around with their mantras and chants and crystals, he makes fun of that, and that should be made fun of. But Ion makes fun of all that too, and Ion is a more vicious environment or more ecstatic environment than anything that's known by New Age. But I would imagine that Croker and associates would think, if they heard what we're doing here, that we were New Agey. I mean, this is what Reverend Stang calls us, New Agey. We're not New Agey. And we show it by including Croker. We include Croker because we go past Croker. And look what we're including here, Croker. When I'm reading, I bet you 99% of you people there don't have a clue what he's talking about. You never heard it before. It's not a negative. It's not your inferior, but it is something that is as powerful as McLuhan was in the 60s.
Well, hey, Bob, I'm catching bits of what it, but are you saying, like, that Croker is talking about excremental culture?
Yes, excremental is his definition of the whole virtual reality, and then there's four subsets of excremental culture, the four TVs, sacrificial, disciplinary, surveillance, and crash.
Well, here's like an Edgar Allan-ish quote by McLuhan that kind of ties it, dovetails, or whatever you want to call it, is parallel, complementary to that comment, and that is, the more the databanks record about each one of us, the less we exist. So whether the databank's a camera or a computer, any formal recording from an arbitrary point of view that isn't through the eyes of each individual is exactly that, a record
takes away bits
of our personality.
You reminded me of the other quote I wanted to say. McLuhan said in 77, because the data machines, the data banks, had more information on each one of us than we could remember, McLuhan said that people were putting on forgetfulness, adopting amnesia as a strategy, like the camcorder generation going vague. The baby boomers became amnesiac just to counter the fact and to rebel against the fact that data banks knew more than they knew about themselves.
It's almost like a survival instinct to maintain their misunderstanding but sensing of the mystery landscape.
Yeah, Croker talks about how what saves humans against this digital onslaught is human stubbornness. Humans are stubborn. They will still live in their delusions, and that has a service to it.
Yeah.
They'll still think there's something worth running as president of the United States. They'll still have elections. You know, it's human stubbornness that Croker celebrates, which is not the characteristic that New Age people celebrate. They want you to become more tolerant, more expanded, more into the light, and more positive, and all this non-stubborn things. New Age thinking is to counter the stubborn moral majority, or the stubborn sound majority, or the stubbornness of human stupidity, you know. And here's Croker celebrating stubbornness. Because when you fully realize what we're up against with this virtual reality and you don't like being absorbed by it, you're going to start celebrating things like punk rock, which Coker did, and anything. You celebrate anything that's contrary to the digital positivity. It's called viral positivism or positivity. It's a technical term. Anyways, if you look at my tiny note chart, you look at the very top, you will see the categories: excremental TV, sacrificial TV, surveillance TV, disciplinary TV, and crash TV. If you look at it, I don't have it right here, you'll see it's matched up with each quadrant. The far right is the LaRouche, the far left is the LaRouche quadrant. So you can see how you can take disciplinary TV, and if you look, if anybody's got the chart right there, you'll see that's under Thompson or Croker, I'm not sure which. And so then you would match that with that body.
I'm looking on my phone to see if I have that new chart that you put out like about a couple months ago. But don't wait for me because I really doubt I'll find it.
All right, so is anybody, like Ginny, are you still impressed with Croker as you were last week?
Are you asking me, Bob?
No, I said Ginny.
Okay.
I take that as a resounding no, Bob.
She's on mute, mowing the lawn, cooking food, you know. Waiting to hear, just sort of getting glimpses of it, and then re-listen to it in the recording or something. And that might be her alibi. Okay, Sheila.
Perfect, Bob. This is the mimetic dimension of this call. Is people like just stubbornly disengaging with diagnosis here. It's like, we're not really interested in knowing, Bob. I'm just going to cook my dinner and just get my stuff done. And,
Well, we're still recording, so it's like the kids mumbling or the amnesia.
Yeah, so you bring up that the Bipple about McLuhan saying that if there's a data bank, then you don't exist. That's dealing with the chemical body. Croker is talking about the virtual landscape, where the virtual body, virtual reality, is archiving the electronic body and the photographic body, all the previous media. The virtual reality doesn't archive human beings. It doesn't care about chemical bodies.
It's only
archiving other extensions, analog media extensions, before itself. So there's a difference there between so the TV, so crash TV, sacrificial TV, because they're being absorbed by virtual data banks and virtual reality, they adopt the no memory status. They adopt amnesia. And so that's your normal news broadcast. They just go from one story to another. So actually, the old analog media adopt the defensive mechanisms that humans did in the 60s and 70s. You see?
Yeah. It's like a fractal that changes landscapes, chemical, and then one's inside the chip, all the different... the different slight subtle differences between virtual, electronic, photographic, television, everything that has an ability to record an angle of your supposed existence, they maintain the same stubbornness, but they kind of like, the foreground dominant one is constantly switching in the way that a fractal changes back into itself through some...
Okay. So that pattern, you're right, with the fractal, that's the eye putting order into it.
Right,
but you have to then flip it into the anamorphic, the Trump Leo. So that nice pattern of the fractal being the content, it's called maze on a beam. EN, this is in italics, or it's French, I think. EN, ABYME, on a beam.
ENABYME?
Yeah.
Okay.
Croker uses that term.
With anything embedded within the other thing.
Right. Like you think of Aunt Jemima's, pancake box, where the picture of her holding up the box is on the box.
Right. The feedback loop of the camera pointing at the TV while the camera is also connected to the TV.
Yes, in some cases. It doesn't flip the image when you do TV like the mirror. But anyways, yes, that recursive infinity mirror.
Escher. MC Escher.
Oh, Tarantino. Inglourious
yeah,
Basterds?
It's not Escher. It's just a simple, an image within an image within an image.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, that is on a beam. You will see Coker use that word every now and then. If you don't know what it means, you won't be able to follow along. But he says the digital reality for the eye is always on a beam. It's always inside itself. But the anamorphosis is not that. The anamorphosis moves into the Escher, the moving out of the perspective tunnel of on a beam where one image is inside another. That's still within the framework of what McLuhan calls visual space. When you move into tactile space and the Trump Leo, the orderliness of on a beam is erased. So it becomes maze on a beam. It becomes canceled. So you come to this situation where Coker, I'm now going to throw some more Coker into this because there's so much you can do. He
yeah.
says he's going to explain crash music. Crash music, therefore, for the body without organs, for sex without secretions, for flared eyes of the body telematic, for smells without eroding skin, and for neon ears without skulls. Then he says, music rules. Now, the whole thing that holds us together is music.
Frank Zappa.
No, any music.
Well, I'm saying music
virtual,
is the best.
Virtual music. No, Zappa may not have understood this.
Okay.
His music is the best was usurped by virtual reality. So Coker says, like advertising, fashion, and cinema before, music rules today as a dominant ideogram of power, not a reflection of a serious materialist power, which emanates elsewhere, and that precedes it. That's the idea. That's the conspiracy theorist. The materialist power is the Rothschilds, you know, the IMF, the
material
center headquarters. This is not how music rules, and it's not that kind of power. Music is a real ruling laboratory of the age of sacrificial power. We are living today in the triumphant but desperate era of aestheticized recommodification. The simulational age of designer subjectivities, where the commodity form most of all needs to be aestheticized to ensure its endless circulation through the debris of all the seductive objects of consumer culture, here music is an empty force, an empty force field through which all the fibrillated subjects pass. It lends a momentary coherency, just momentary, to a system of objects that always threatens to collapse in the direction of entropy and burnout. No longer only a simulation, music is now the key code of the postmodern body as a war machine. Music then is a force field through which processed subjects pass, with its privileging of pure speed, of sound approaching the velocity of light, with its vectoring of random subjects across a keyboard of outward emotions, with its inscription of the codes of frenzy and desire onto the body without organs, and with its fatal promise of pure inertia when the sound switches off and all the dancing bodies collapse. It is how postmodern bodies speak to one another, how they collude, conspire, and seduce. Here, the internal rhythms and grammatical codes of the war machine are transcribed into auditory codes that can only be seen with the ears and heard with the eyes. And so, an interesting question arises. What is the relationship between the inertial grammatical codes of postmodern society as a war machine and the acoustical sounds of music? Crash music is not as much a representation on a beam. See, there it is, on a beam. It's not that. That's representational, eye-based, particular phases within each other. So crash music is not as much a representation on a beam of particular phases of culture, but it is one of the real, world of political economy. Crash music exists as a culture smasher, a cultural cyclotron in the era of crash economy, which is to say that culture is not a reflex of political economy, but that society is now a reflex of key shifts in music theater and practice. In other words, the boom of the junk economy since 1983, the last 25 years, was not run by the economy. It was run by music. That whole, you know, moving the stock market up to 15,000 was caused by music, is what Croker's saying in 1991.
Does this have anything to do with that thing you were talking about with Richard Meltzer of Cliché to Archetype?
That would be an introduction to what Croker's saying, but it doesn't get to Croker.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
Yeah, so what he's saying is that music is not a reflection of society. Society is a reflection of music. Music is the ground. And it can only be, it's the closest phenomenon that can keep up with the fact in the virtual reality, quantum fluctuations, where you only know that you've never seen what you thought you were looking at because you never really heard what you were listening to. So there is no sound. No, there is no registration of the chemical body. But for the digital mirror of that, music is the closest to keep up with this quantum disappearance. So he says, music rules in the quantum age because sound moves faster than the speed of light. That's quickly eclipsing history. And we were talking about everybody wants amnesia. We don't want any history. And then television didn't want any history. So how do you move faster than that? You do it with music. So Coker says, study music theory then as a laboratory of big transformations in power and economy. You will have then the punk period of the economy, the sampler phase of the economy, the house music era, the heavy metal economy, and then the rap aesthetics for the commodified body. So the point is, I'm reading this difficult stuff that was written 20 years ago, and how puny Marshall's writings, there are not enough words in Marshall to cover the Baroque spirals that has happened over the last 25 years. At least Croker is keeping up with the Baroque spirals and making these absurd inventories of stuff that people can't even begin to understand.
Perhaps one of the issues here, Bob, is that McLuhan still existed and spoke when there were forms. And so in a sense, he could only either be prophetic about media forms or landscapes, whereas Croker, writing in a post-media landscape age, has to be more comprehensive reporting on these cultural Baroque spirals. There's more things that have to be admitted.
Yeah, and he can, because we're in the information supernova society, by the 80s, and there's more material available. Back in McLuhan's day, you got three TV networks. There'd be a fad about every 20 months. Zappa said every 18 months. You know, there'd be the hippies, and then there'd be the yippies, and then there'd be the STS and the blowing up of Kent State, and then there would be the streaker. You know what I mean? Very slow. He said back then it was 200 years every 12 months. Well, by the time of Crokerland, there's no time happening. It's a trillion years every 1 second. Another way of saying that you can't even see what's going on. Back at McLuhan's level, you could still see phenomena. So, you know, Croker does use McLuhan's method, but as always, the new form is different from the previous form.
Yeah, that's a nice wrap, Bob, actually. We're actually, just for timing's sake, we're an hour and a half in. At any point, I guess we can go for another 30 minutes or something like this, or unless something amazing happens, we can shut down and reconvene.
Right. I wanted to just – you brought up McLuhan. Yeah. Coker's right. See, McLuhan is talking about the language of form as it extended. He then saw that it was coming alive – and the closest you get to what Croker's talking about is the last page of War and Peace in Global Village, 1968, where he says the media turn into the outbreeders and animals and start eating people. That is said in McLuhan's later phases. Right, Andrew?
Yep.
It's just that and Croker's not doing anything in the 70s and 80s. He's writing conventional stuff. But by the late 80s, after MTV and the beginning of virtual reality, there was enough stuff that he could step in and do what McLuhan wasn't around to do.
He probably remembered McLuhan again and realized that, like what that guy was saying, that no one seemed up for the challenge, and he wasn't acknowledging you, Bob, but like how very few people, I guess, maybe had the credentials of like Croker to actually bother to continue to extrapolate what McLuhan was like getting at.
Well, here's what Croker did, inspired by David Cook. In the 70s, 80s, Croker did a lot of work. He read all of, Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Barthes, Baudrillard, Virilio, and Foucault. These are difficult things. This is what college students had to read in the 80s and 90s. Maybe Andrew had to read some of it in his school. Maybe James had to read it. These were new texts, Baroque spirals for books, which McLuhan predicted that academia would go medieval and get into very hyper-excessive complications of left hemisphere activity, because they're sitting there in a paralyzed state as the andromine grows around them. So Croker is 20 years of reading this stuff, and then he comes into – he's an expert on it, just like I read all of McLuhan's articles. So I knew all McLuhan's stuff. I could come back and play with it. Croker could play and dance on the toes of the postmodernists Baudrillard and these guys, because he knew their work, and that was a lot of work. Now, he, being a professor, he had time to read it, and he taught it. So you had to be, you know, your average citizen was not reading that stuff, didn't even know what these words, what these themes were. So he was, just like McLuhan had the advantage of going to Cambridge and being in university for many years and read a lot, you need to do, like any great poet, you need to do your homework, at least if you're going to make a commentary. So Croker's books are the last books to write. You know, who would be, who requires a cultural commentator today?
Well, we require you.
Yeah, and I'm coming in with the help of Ion. So, and that's very controversial, and we'll do well. We'll do well. But within the, you know, the non-Ionic world of the McLuhan Conference, these ridiculous people this past 6 months putting on these boring McLuhan talks, you know, they're examples. They're talking to nobody because everybody's busy making their own cultural commentary with Web 2.0.
Yeah. They can all unite on the fact that they're like, yes, he was in a movie by Woody Allen in 1980. Isn't that charming?
Yeah,
I too have an uncle. You know, it's like retarded.
Yeah, if Buzz Kosten was not making YouTubes of my stuff, I would not be on the map. You've got to be YouTube. You've got to be on there. That's the only medium that exists.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, I mean, yeah.
Even Croker had to make a couple of YouTubes.
It'd be kind of a sin to, like, not use any of this stuff.
Yeah, so I'm really enjoying rereading Croker. It's really incredible what he wrote. I mean, when I read it, when it came out, I knew it, and I built on it, but I already knew these insights. As a matter of fact, when Croker heard my album, or whatever he heard first of me, he says, Bob's doing what I'm doing. He immediately recognized that I was on the same level. But I was not doing I was not an expert in all the postmodernists. I couldn't have written these books.
Well, like, and didn't you say with the Meltzer talk how, like, the French theorists kind of did the same thing that the French cinéastes did with the American film? Like, for all intents and purposes, all those guys retrieved McLuhan and just filtered them with their own cultural bias, but essentially were coming to the same conclusions?
Yeah, you go through my long essay, which is on the McLuhan Imam, McLuhan on Maui, where you see that I go through the five schools of media ecology. That's on there. I go through all these groups, Croker and everybody, and I show McLuhan quotes, many quotes from McLuhan, what they built on. They definitely are repeating McLuhan, but, of course, they dance on the toes of McLuhan and go in a different direction. Derrida is another guy that you had to read back then. Derrida comes to a conference in 1971 and purposefully lays out the visual acoustic dynamic of McLuhan and then reverses it and makes the opposite meanings for McLuhan's terms.
Well, that's you know, that's like the kind of like the American self and the French, you know, being the audio bias, you know, like the speech bias or something like that.
Yeah. No, the South is oral, and they...
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, it's like by them saying it, it's kind of like there's a quote on the Medium is the Massage album where it's like, we're not sure who discovered water, but we're definitely sure it's not the fish. And I thought that they said batter, right? Like a battered fish, like breaded fish. And I was like, that's hilarious. And then they're talking about how, like, print, you know, made the formality of the word being, you know, classified, and you could read it was water. So now the phonetic connotation, which I thought was batter, that's what, you know, that's what's ending right now. You know what I mean? Like the economy, the whole print-oriented maps, streets, and all that shit, that's ending now because of the return back into acoustic space, and that's...
We're not returning to acoustic space. Come on.
Well,
we're not even returning to tactile space. That's McLuhan land. In Croker
land,
we're watching the Android... No, listen.
Okay.
You got to get this. You can't use McLuhan terms, visual and acoustic space, and even tactile space. The point of Croker and what I'm saying is that we're watching the Android meme adopt tactile space.
Okay.
That's the bimodern.
No one's real anymore.
Yeah, well, they didn't even show up to be real.
Right.
They didn't. We never arrived, Barbara.
Right, and the ones that, with the teenagers now, I mean, my... boyfriend has a 19-year-old daughter and a nephew who's 18, a niece who's 18. They want to be famous, or they're all about texting. They don't do anything social interacting, ex- except...
Well, you mean the chemical body. They don't do their chemical body. They know the only reality to be existing is to be welcomed by the Android meme, by being famous, or staying in touch and monitoring it through their hypertexting. Yeah, they're panic kids. Well, they're having panic teenagehood.
So, Bob, like, when you're saying the Android meme is, how did you associate the Android meme and acoustic tactile space again?
In the analog phase of media, you know, had the extensions of the central nervous system with the telegraph and radio and TV. You had the extensions of the eye. All the stuff McLuhan does, he's talking about the extensions of the chemical body. Now, Coker's point is the extensions come alive and they come alive and they invade the chemical body and splatter it all over the world. So there's no chemical body left. And then the Android meme begins to extend itself and create tactile virtuality, visual virtuality. Remember I was listing off those descriptions of the different types of eyes and faces and scanner eyes?
That'd be tactility, Bob?
No. Tactility is extended by electricity. The Android meme takes tactility and then turns it into synesthesia and anamorphoses it. So looking, I list off eyes and ears and mixing up.
Like the quote you're talking about the crash eye, the photographic eye, that thing?
Yeah, it was... Here it is. Remember, sampling, this book, Spasm, is all about the CD that Croker and Steve Gibson made. And Croker is saying that Steve Gibson's way more important than any other musician. John Zorn, I don't even know if he knows about Zappa, but he would lump Zappa in there, but he didn't know enough about Zappa. But he's saying Steve Gibson's CD is the most amazing phenomenon for the ear that you can experience, and this book is explaining why Steve Gibson's CD is important. And there's a whole 40-page section in the middle of the book written by Steve Gibson. But here, so the sampling that Steve Gibson does is the way music rules. It has to be sampling. So I'll repeat that paragraph. He says, the pre-digital ear, that's the McLuhan world, the analog extensions of the ear, radio, but the pre-digital ear is the first victim of sound trompe-l'oeils. Now, trompe-l'oeil is a visual thing. So how do you have a sound trompe-l'oeil? Anyways, he writes it. He says, from the virtual sound of Madonna Mutant to the virtual body of Michael Jackson. So then, an urgent requirement emerges to speed up the analog ear, the radio-consuming ear, to match the oral velocity of digital reality, to pump up the genetics of hearing to equal the sounds of the datascape. Sampling technology, therefore, as a filter for mutant eardrums, looped ears, partitioned hearing, panned sound, accelerated eardrums, time-stretched sound, digit-designed ears. These are things that the Android meme will make, and the chemical body sits on the sidelines watching. And if the chemical body has a chance, it might get some genetic, go in the hospital and get its ear changed. Now, that artist, Stellark, does that. He had an ear put on his arm. Have you ever seen that, Andrew, that footage?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah.
And also on that note, Bob, I've got a drop. I'm sorry, so I'll leave you to it. I've got students coming to my door, so thank you very much. And I look forward to listening to the rest of it when the recording comes through. So.
Yeah, I'm only going to record another 10 minutes or something, and then I'm going too. But so you liked how we did it today?
I think this session is exceptional.
Okay, good. So you don't mind this excessive quoting of Croker?
It was a lecture in the old traditional sense of the word, of a reading of, and I think establishing this McLuhan-Croker dynamic and using Croker as a waypoint to getting to Bob's town is useful, Bob. It's useful.
Yeah, not good, but useful. Okay, great.
And, so thank you, and thank you all, and sorry, I'm out, so cheers.
That's all right. So
hey, Andrew.
So we got Barbara speaks, Bipple speaks, anybody, Hugh, if you speak, start talking, because I'm not going on for a couple hours.
Where does society go from here?
It doesn't.
Does it go along with it?
No, society disappeared, and we're describing the Android meme's creation of society over the last 30 years, and now we're witnessing the collapse of the Android meme society, and that's where Ion comes in. So if Ion wants to say something now, if he's around, he can speak, or they can speak and address Barbara's point. But do you understand, Barbara? You're talking as a chemical body thinking there's a society. No, That society disappeared 40 years ago. McLuhan says 100 years ago. And then as analog media extended itself, it completed with the satellite, then it started to be digitized and started to consume the planet and all previous societies, and then made its own virtual society, which is what your children grew up in over the last 25 years. And now I'm saying that that's collapsing.
Bob, would you say that when McLuhan flashed on his concept of the phone making us discarnate and his simultaneous constant propping up of Finnegan's Wake for the all-encompassing expression of all technologies, past, present, future, is that formally and almost linearly drawn out with the Android meme going burning itself out, trying to essentially mimic the chip body of the drama of cognition?
See, you go on with too many words. You start
I'm
off
sorry.
With the phone, which is a good point. The phone and Finnegan's Wake is a phone conversation. Nobody saw that. Matter of fact, some people think either the love song Jail for Prufrock by T.S. Eliot or The Wasteland, can't remember which, but I think it's Prufrock, is a telephone conversation. And when people read that poetry in the teens and 20s, almost 100 years ago, they thought they were reading a linear 19th century book poem. They didn't know that the telephone was the hidden metaphor in there. So anyways, Joyce picked up on that with Finnegan's Wake. So then you're talking about analog media, 60 years ago. Now then you jump the Android meme. What? How do you connect the 2 points?
Well, that leap, just how a lot of people connect Finnegan's Wake and texting, and how, like, in a lot of ways, it was a flash, and there was no term to describe
okay.
it.
Okay, now that's what you describe. That's the Don Thiel point. Finnegan's Wake is even more than what McLuhan predicted, or said that was in Finnegan's Wake. McLuhan said it might have had... Well, Barry Nevitt said it had the computer. But Marshall basically saw television in Finnegan's Wake and comics and all the other previous media. The digital reality that one can see in Finnegan's Wake is what Don Thiel emphasized. And he became famous in the 90s as an old professor, retrieving McLuhan during the McLuhan fad, pointing out the obsolescence of McLuhan because McLuhan's language is too simple. You need to go back to the original text of Finnegan's Wake and see the complexity of it, and it mimed the Android meme and email world that people were starting to move into. So Thiel got a lot of attention in the early 90s by postmodern critics by saying, let's go back to Finnegan's Wake and look at it. It's better than McLuhan to understand the digital culture.
Okay.
Now yes, follow this. The Croaker does a better description of virtual reality than Finnegan's Wake, but Croaker never talks about Finnegan's Wake, and that's what is missing in Croaker. You could bridge McLuhan to Croaker by understanding Thiel and my take on Finnegan's Wake. And then you have a connection to that. See, so what you were asking, went from the phone to the Android meme, is really where my answer is what your question was trying to articulate.
Right, but the discarnate aspect, the discarnate statement that McLuhan would say all the time, that is involved somehow in the Android meme because of the fact
Okay, here's what you need. The telegraph and then the radio and then television and the telephone allowed people to have ESP technically. They would watch things happening in another part of the world live in their room. So they were where the camera was and they were in their room. That was the extension of tactile in, through the membrane.
Right.
Discarnate in 2 places at once, in 100 places at once. Now, that's I call that the landscape, the electric analog landscape. Okay, you got the phone ringing. And what the digital reality does, it aborts that discarnate state that McLuhan says, shrinks it, and then gives it to you on a smaller scale, and I call that a body. So the massive discarnate environments of electric analog media from 1900 to 1960, human chemical bodies were inside of, that becomes shrunk. So actually today, we're not discarnate anymore. We have the discarnate experience as a sub-organ, a sub-body of ourselves, and we do it on our iPhone. But it's not, you're not inside a huge landscape. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
As Europe was in the 30s under radio. They were swallowed up by radio. Now radio is this little ear thing, and Croker's description of the ears, virtual ears and all that, and the surge of repaired and geneticized ears, that's what these kids are growing up. Barbara's kids There's no chemical body there. There's a kid trying to keep up with the Android meme developing digital ears.
Right.
That's
right,
how
right.
extreme you got to look at it. You got to look at your kid as not having a chemical body. But what's interesting is that the digital shrinking makes the chemical body think it's in control again because it's bigger than the media. But why is it so neurotically trying to reconnect with the digital space? Because the digital space is bigger than the chemical body of the kid. It's much like Ion pointing out that the space inside your body, the space between the cells, is so huge that if you just take the physical part of your body, it would only make up the size of a sugar cube. If you took 6 billion chemical bodies and took the non-physical that's in between their cells away from those 6 billion bodies, you'd just be left with a sugar cube. That's how huge the non-physical is, and then we can think of the digital space as an extension of the non-physical. That's the huge space that Barbara's kid is always trying to be in touch with. And you can't see that space, but it's there trying to wiggle with it.
So are you saying the kids are non-physical?
Beg your pardon?
Are you saying the kids are non-physical?
No, I'm
what
saying
they're consciously
that
trying to identify with.
No, the non-physical has been extended by the chip landscape, and that's why Ion can play and create in the chip landscape. The chip landscape is like bigger than non-physical. So the kids have non-physical. Every human being has non-physical, but it's they're trying to relate that and their physical body to the new space of the chip body. Now that's a Trump allele to try to visualize. That's an anamorphic weird image for you to try to visualize what I'm talking about.
Placing of infinity.
No, that's I. That's directional. That's mirroring. It's as you notice in Croker's prose style, he's always erasing what he wrote. So you have this. This is your kid. I go to page 53 of Spasm. Your son, who is the only kid who's been on Cashflow and talked to Ion, and has had pretty good effects about that, and Barbara might be presenting that on Wednesday. Right, Barbara?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So your son's name's Max, right?
Right,
so,
he's 8.
Max is a being of quantum fluctuations where we can only know that we have never seen what we thought was Max because when we were looking at Max, we never heard what he was saying. No, I'm trying to adapt what I said earlier. You missed it. Here's the quote from Croker. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. So the ear is the ground. You actually aren't hearing what you think you're hearing. And if you think there's an object connected to that, a visual object, that's not true because you never heard what you heard. See, this is very complex writing trying to point the erasure that's happened under Android meme conditions for the chemical body and even for the spiritual body. And that's why it's very interesting that Ion shows up to offer a imaging of the mystery landscape.
Well, okay, when you say Trump Leal, on Wikipedia there's a picture called Escaping Criticism, and it has a kid kind of like walking through a picture frame. But that is the picture, but it appears three-dimensional. And what they're saying is that it's an art technique involving extremely realistic imagery in order to create the optical illusion that the depicted objects appear in three dimensions. So when you always say Trump, Leal, there's obviously a merging of what's being observed and the observer.
Yeah. And when that merger, that's what happens when we watch television. The subject and the object merged, and we became the screen. But when the Android meme took that TV landscape where the viewer was the screen, which was a big environment everybody was inside of, and shrunk it and kind of put it off in the corner as like a little marble and moved you into a weird new space, which was watching the Android meme do that itself.
Okay.
The Android meme allowed its movie content to merge with radio content. That's what Buzz tries to do on his YouTubes.
Well,
he's always...
well, hang on, Scooter. We've got a little issue here.
Go ahead.
The problem is what you're forgetting is the TV is watching you. You aren't watching the TV.
You know, that's true, and McLuhan talked about that. We just didn't have time to say it.
The point that you're trying to lay out here is that the Android meme has an effect on the outcome, and that's not the case.
No, no. Here's the way to do it. You say TV's watching you. The Android meme is not watching you. It's watching the other media environments and screwing with them.
Well, but those become the meme that you gauge what tomorrow's forecast looks like.
You bring back, you try to keep the chemical body in the play here. We have to erase the chemical body and then come back to what you're hoping survives the situation.
That's the distance between the is-is and the arnesses, isn't it?
Right. And your language is very tiny and puny compared to Kroger's language. But I recognize what you are trying to do because you're actually providing an energy plateau or platform that goes around the chip body or puts you in a position of poise to enjoy it.
Well, ours ends in an orgasm, and Kroger leaves you frustrated.
Yeah, that's true. That's why Dobbstown, you know, is better than Krokerland.
Absolutely. 101. That's exactly right. That it becomes to completion. And that's the point you're trying to help the brethren with, Bob. But
no, I'm not. That's your point. That's what we do on Cashflow. We are specializing in what happened before Ion showed up here, and we did McLuhan for 22 sessions. Now we're doing Kroger, of course, pointing to you. Now, I would say it begins with you when you bring McLuhan in. Not you interpreting McLuhan, you bring him in, and he speaks to us. If you want to do that today, I'll keep the recording going.
Oh, please yourself. We're hot as a $2 pistol. We're easy.
Okay, well, is McLuhan there to speak to?
Ask.
Okay, guys, start asking McLuhan as if he's there.
Oh, boy.
I thought we were thought you were going to
Barbara,
talk to
Barbara. Barbara, McLuhan is there. If you were with McLuhan, what would you ask him?
Well, I just said, oh boy, and apparently
no,
that was
no,
the
yeah,
last
we don't
thing
need your stop wasting time, Barbara. You got questions?
Okay. Well,
him. You're talking to him, Barbara. Address McLuhan.
Okay, McLuhan.
He's right there.
What would you say? What do you have to say to us now that we haven't covered before?
Good question.
Oh, it was all a cruel hoax.
No, and then you got to say, Barbara, what was a cruel hoax? Because he says
what
it. What does it refer
hoax
to?
Okay, all right. What was a cruel hoax?
The whole media ecology as it applies to the ramifications of what you call reality now. What the point that's been missed and obfuscated in this whole process is how it applies into your now. Your now is what's in play. Your now is what's in question. And how it applies to your now is what's not been dealt with any detail.
So it's the same as it ever was.
Because when you say my son's disappeared, I'm sorry, I can't agree with that. I see.
No, I say that. McLuhan didn't say that. Kroger says it.
When Bob says that.
Ask McLuhan what he would say about your son. You're talking to McLuhan. Forget about being Kroger.
Okay.
What would you say about my son or about young kids today?
Well, as the leading edge of creation, he sets the parameters by which the reality is judged. It's what media ecology, the essence of media ecology, becomes or becomes from. Because you're looking at the world from rose-colored glasses. You're missing the point. Your son looks at it from a leading edge. That's the difference.
So would you say that everybody is an artist in the sense of how you were referring to artists?
No, we wouldn't say that.
No, we're not saying that. Now, I will just come in as a quote McLuhan expert. What Marshall, McLuhan, if that was McLuhan, that's exactly McLuhan's point. He said you've got to study the kids, and he had the advantage of being a teacher and watching the kids from the 40s on. Well, watching the kids, that's where he got his information from. He watched the kids. And that's what Marshall just said now. He's consistent with the real Marshall, as I knew him.
Do
it means yes.
They're expanding into all these digital environments and landscapes, but they're not necessarily losing themselves in
them.
They're
creating. Those landscapes have to land, or they're not landscapes. Until those landscapes become in the mystery environment, as Bob lays out, they don't matter. They're antimatter, as it were. Until it applies, it is not.
Okay, so you're saying like the digital landscape has not landed?
Not so far. Ask Max.
Okay, I see him just playing with it, but he does a lot of other stuff too. That's physical.
Chemical. So did we.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, when you were young, you did the crystal radio stuff, right? Shortwave in the 20s. Is that what you mean?
Are you talking to McLuhan?
I'm talking to McLuhan.
Not me.
McLuhan just said, so did we. You meant, that's Marshall talking, saying when he was a teenager, he played with those little crystal sets.
Most certainly, because the wave was the wave. That was the frequency that was. The frequency that was established was the one that we had to work with. Any others were moot.
So does Max know what technologies are coming? You see, he
absolutely
knows what's coming. Right.
Absolutely. Just as we did when we were playing with it in the 60s.
Yeah.
And that put us on the avant-garde leading edge of ridiculousness. That ridiculousness became the apropos to the medium of the moment.
Right. It resonated with what the people were looking for, so you became a figure.
Well, figure ground as it applies to your what you used to call mystery landscape, but it's not so mysterious any longer, is it?
Mm-hmm. No.
And Max is actually playing with the mystery landscape now.
Right.
Certainly. And he's all of?
8.
Well, there
you
go. There you go.
But when Ion says the kids are leading, or when this McLuhan here with Ion says the kids are the leading edge, that's exactly what Marshall would talk about. And he used to quote that pre-literate societies had rigid youth and flexible elders, and the elders always watched what the kids were doing. If there was an issue, a problem in the tribe, the elders knew the kids would mirror it, reflect it, give clues
to
it.
That's the best example of what you use as the word is Trump Leo, and a little child understood it, got it, and the socio perception that inclusively includes the child's perspective moved beyond what you normal, mature, voting, smoking, drinking, happily engaging, imbibing humans relegated as normal.
Okay, is that Marshall talking or Ion?
Do Marshall.
Okay. So, James and others, ask Marshall McLuhan questions.
Do you, Marshall McLuhan, remember your address on Gertrude in Winnipeg?
128.
Okay.
What's the difference between tactility and tactility?
Tactility applies to what you think you know. Tactility applies to the part you thought you knew.
Well, it was a pleasure speaking with you all. I'll speak to you next week.
Okay. Thanks for your contribution.
How did your mother affect you in the way that you viewed the world?
The same as Mother Mary affected Jesus.
Well, that was pretty
profound.
The myth is that was a pretty profound affecting by Mother Mary on Jesus. Or is that not the case?
That is the case.
So the mother was very profound, your mother's effect on you.
Most absolutely.
Were you involved with Rosicrucians or the study of the Rosicrucian religion?
No.
When you commented that the TV generation was very
no.
serious versus the...
No, wait, Marshall, let him get his statement out. You know, you do it again, Fu or Hugh.
you commented that the pre-TV generation had a much lighter heart than the TV generation. What was it about the TV generation that
made them grim?
Yes.
Well, the answer is no, that was not the case or the stance at all.
Well, wait, that's what you're recorded as saying. Are you saying you were wrong on that point?
No, we're saying no, that wasn't the case.
Why did you say it then?
The fallout or the difference between is what we were speaking about. We were talking about the elocution of how it applies to the meme then and the meme now. And the question came from the standpoint of how it applies, and we say, no, it does not apply.
Wait, you mean now today or now in the 60s?
Now without a chip body. That's when we answered the question.
But yeah, you're talking about back in the 60s when you said now.
Right, but you had a chip body to it. Now the whole landscape is diverse.
Right, but we're talking about back then. Why did you say that the TV generation was more grim than the radio generation?
Because they didn't. The only reason you had a radio generation is because they were watching the radio until they could see something.
Right, and then the next generation could see something. So what were they anticipating?
They didn't anticipate a thing. They took as is, as was.
Because it was completed. You could basically see and hear.
If they were listening to the radio regarding Niagara Falls and they could see a picture of Niagara Falls, it was solved. It came full circle.
Right. So you're saying that you didn't mean the grimness. It was a context that you were comparing.
Well, it was absolutely the context of what the written word, the Gutenberg Society, laid out and what reality precluded. Not included, precluded. That the world became a divisive place that you could include all, you could know all, you could see all, you could see those starving Somalian children while you wait.
Right. And that did create a little bit more of a mood of grimness sometimes in the TV kids.
Absolutely. Someone could have flatulence in the far, 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 far east, and it would become the meme or the message of the day.
But actually, the TV kids, they were becoming what I later called quadriphenic. They were becoming multi-leveled, not just grim or serious
not
or light or whatever.
Not multi-leveled, not multi-tiered.
Multi-tiered.
They could discern the difference between I Dream of Jeannie and Mirador Gaddafi's latest strategy.
Right. Okay.
How would you say they see things today?
That's what we were speaking of, dear.
Oh, right. Okay.
But let's try to get a sense of Marshall. The way I'd like to hear what he says about what we know he did back then. We don't have to do the whole interview like that, but just build up a bit about, for me, it was accurate what he said about kids. That was one thing. So come up with some more questions about what he would have said or why he said something back then before we get Marshall Tombo today. Ask him about his Catholicism.
Okay. How did you see Catholicism then? How did it affect you and your writing?
Well, the Mass was the interment of the coming together of the scriptures exposed that you could apply into your living life. All right? And with all the, the church's sacraments, those could apply and lead you to perdition that would allow you the ability or capacity to clear any hurdle that you created in your life or your lifespan. Now, that's what the Catholic Mass Seder included. That's why the Mass was so very, very, very important to humans coming into a place where they could apply that applied place of knowing, because it created a synergy that you could use to vehemently dispel and or dispose any creative, what do you call, sin in your world. It allowed you the capacity to redeem yourself. You had a redeemability within the mass. And with a bit of transubstantiation, you had an opportunity. Now, that's
and
not
you,
the case today, but that was the case then.
That's because you were conditioned by your time and subject to the effects of literacy and had senses
well,
of sin.
That's because that's the way it was. It worked.
What would you recommend to the Vatican, to the Catholic Church today, to a new situation?
Run.
Has there something taken the place of the Church in terms of giving us a way to redeem ourselves or for little men to redeem themselves?
Redemption is nigh, and they don't understand that concept.
Who, people don't? We're talking about today.
We're talking about the Church.
Right. They don't understand that redemption is here. Nigh means
yes.
Here.
Correct. Now.
Yeah.
And that's where they've lost. Because all of the hierarchy with Catholicism has lost its flavor. Even an archbishop is subject to question. That's new today.
Yeah, they were an invisible environment that was massaging their constituents. They're now totally figure and objectified, so they've lost the seduction part of the former charisma. Would you agree with that?
The capacity of their power that they portray has all but naught.
Yeah. So they're standing there with no clothes on.
I don't care if it rains or freezes as long as I got my plastic Jesus sitting on the dashboard of my car. It's lost all its flavor. What they have to offer doesn't apply because the mystery landscape, just as you know, Bob, it's been exposed.
Yeah. Okay, that's today. Go back.
There's all but nothing to confess.
Right. And that, I can see McLuhan saying that, sort of, but to me that's Ion talk. I'd like to go back.
No, that's for now. You ask
right.
for now.
Right. I'd like to go back and talk and see if we get echoes or if he can elaborate on themes that, in his terms. For example, who was an influence
Kiel
on...
Croker.
What?
Kiel Croker.
Yeah, before Croker. Yeah, before Croker. You would say today, you do not agree with the use of our Croker that we're using.
Not at all. He's ridiculous. Didn't know what the hell he was talking about.
Well, you've said that about yourself, too. Right? Or did Ion say that about you? No, you've said that to me.
We've said that.
Yeah. Okay, so it's okay. Well, we have Croker for a transitional point to get to here.
Well, the transitional point, it's only that's lacking or less than. You're trying to fill the gap. You're trying to fill the Android meme with words from Croker that don't apply.
Well, I find that they enhance the listener. They are finding
it
very interesting. So that we're here to entertain. We're not here to do serious work. That's done on Wednesday.
Have a little Mae Russell, and it'd be candy dancer, wouldn't it?
It's up to the clientele. They don't even speak here. Most of them don't even speak. I mean, just lurking.
That's fair.
No.
But I
want to know how things
just
affect.
Just don't obfuscate the position that you're trying to.
Yeah. You can go on about. Go ahead, Barbara.
I was just going to say, I would disagree with you, Bob. Me personally, and the other people. I'm sure you're.
You haven't even heard the Croker. You don't even know what we're talking about, Barbara. So your opinion of Croker is irrelevant.
He's still kicking. Nope. So what you got to do?
Yeah, go ahead, Barbara. Go ahead. What do you want to say?
I'm just saying what I did hear when I did join in. It sounded kind of depressing. If
it is. See, we're not here. We are not here to make you feel good. Croker is out to depress the hell out of you. So you stop running around with fake positivity.
It's over. Now
here's the thing, Barbara. You start reading Croker. You got to read the whole book and then find at the end where he sees the breakthrough point. He is not depressing if you get to the end where he gives his prescription and his solution. But you got to go through all that stuff to find out what the situation is. You got to get the disease, get the press for new reasons, not for obsolete reasons, and then find the solution. There is a solution for Croker in the mid-90s in his books. Okay? He inspired a lot of people to do some things. Now, I'm not saying that it worked. I'm not saying that it worked. Hey, Ian, I'm not saying that it worked, but it was
the thing that your Ion was playing for you earlier.
Yeah, yeah, you played some Croker.
Well,
and you missed
Croker,
that, Barbara.
That Croker is the solution where you come back and you obfuscate the whole position that was being.
Well, that Croker is a fragment. You're not dealing with what he was saying. You've put a little fragment. So let's not talk about Croker. We're trying to talk, and this is McLuhan's view. Am I talking to McLuhan or Ion?
McLuhan.
Right.
Ion wouldn't have 5 seconds of this mess.
I know. You're right. So McLuhan, you had a big ego. You didn't think anybody would get it. So you're in character here putting down Croker.
They haven't so far. We're hoping, but they
haven't so far. Barbara, this is McLuhan's personality. That's what we're getting here. Mm-hmm. He said everybody was stupid, and he's still doing it today, it sounds.
Well, so far, they haven't impressed us yet.
Well, does Ion impress you, McLuhan?
Well, Ion completes it. Ion puts it in a perspective that is at least adjustable.
Yeah, we know that. I mean, I'm not identifying with Croker. I just know the usefulness of this situation.
It's a quadrant that brings into position the qualification of the eight bodies.
Yes, the eight bodies.
That you tried to land at five bodies, which are now obsolete.
Right. So Barbara or James, somebody, asked McLuhan some questions about what you know about him when he was here.
Well, this is Ginny, and I want to know what are the eight bodies.
Ah, come on, Ginny. That's another whole topic. That's not the topic. We're talking to McLuhan. What do you know about McLuhan? You think you know something about Finnegan's Wake? Ask him about Finnegan's Wake. We're talking to McLuhan, Ginny.
From your perspective now, how has it changed from your perspective then of his work, Finnegan's
Now
Wake?
Complete.
Yeah, because you transitioned, and then you could see what you failed to get, what Zappa failed to get, and what Joyce failed to get. You can see that.
Well, we can see the play for Cypher clearly, because now we have absconded the whole position that validate the ramification of what Joyce was trying to work with.
Yeah, see, Barbara, that's dead McLuhan. Dead McLuhan knows everything. Deal with live McLuhan. Someone here, do you know anything about what you heard about McLuhan? And talk, address that.
Well, I honestly don't know a whole lot, except for the I was in on a conversation regarding how Catholicism influenced you and how your mother.
Well, it was the only game going at the moment because it was the only place where you could have a transubstantiation or a position that you could imbibe regarding. It was the only place where spiritualism applied to the android mean that was relegated to a level or degree of importance. But that was only found within the confines of the what we call a spiritual mass. Outside of that, you were a pedophile waiting to be invaded.
So in the 70s, you start doing yoga. Did you explore beyond just... Did you find that there were other aspects of your religiosity you explored beyond the Mass in the later years?
No. The yoga was just the quieting of the mind in an otherwise an essence sea of not knowing.
Right. Now
there became more questions than there ever became possibility of answers.
Right. The new environments, the implications, you were awake enough to see them. They raised questions in you. You advocated a third Vatican meeting, you know, Vatican II, and then there was Vatican III, around what questions you could raise. You were serious
about
those questions.
Because the periphery had lost flavor.
Yeah. So you did you think that it was an opportunity?
Yeah.
That breakdown for people to hear more of the spiritual dimensions of the Mass.
Most absolutely, because the spiritualness of the Mass is what applied to the ramifications that were being addressed at the moment. It was the essence of the medium as the message.
Right. Now,
outside of that, you were dimly constrained to a position that left you less than.
Right. So once you transitioned and you see what the more complete story, was the Mass adequate to what you think Ion brings forth now?
Well, it could be, lesson except that they never reached the when you got the individuals that were participating in the Mass up to the level or degree of the Preferiti, okay, fine. But until then, you are still, as Ion would say it, pissing in the wind.
You're saying the Preferiti knew how to do the Mass spiritually.
Yeah, well, they would know that, yes. But did they always do it? Not necessarily. But they certainly had the exposure to present it that way. If you go back to the original Latin, it absolutely applied.
Okay, so you experienced the Mass on the level that the Preferiti should have experienced it,
well,
and you knew.
We read Latin. We knew what they were speaking.
Right, that's right. And you read five translations, different languages, you know, every day. Greek and...
when you start applying the Greek to what the scriptures, Kiska say, would say, it certainly made a difference in how you had a defining definition regarding to how the scriptures related to everyday living and everyday life.
So what did you mean when you told Corinne after you transitioned? She told me that you told her once or a couple times in the kitchen after you were gone that you should have spoken more and written more about Jesus. What would you have said?
Well, the dissemination between what Jesus was trying to say and the point of what Jesus actually was recorded as saying. If you applied what Jesus really had to say, you'd get it. And if you applied any other way, you were tried and found wanting.
So you wanted to overcome the effects of the printing press. You wanted to overcome the effects of the printing press in the interpretation of Jesus.
Fine, well, but what's not spoken about is the ascension process.
Yeah.
That's what's left out of the whole process is the ascension. That's what's the least spoken about within the scriptures, especially regarding the Mass, is the ascension.
Now, why didn't you write about it when you were alive?
We did a bit, because within the confessional, that was the limitation of the confessional.
No, what's that mean? You were in the confessional when you wrote, or you wrote about the limitations of the confessional?
No, the
different ways to take those words.
Well, listen. The limitation, the limitation of the confessional was that it doesn't ever reach or broach the position that was even in context outside of the outcome. See, the outcome is what you're talking about here. You're talking about the medium as the message. Well, if you don't get the medium as the message, then the outcome has very little to do with anything within the conversation.
Well, what is your definition of medium?
The medium has to be within the confines of what human genome strategy applies as a positional reality.
Well, you didn't say any of the words that you said when you were alive. We don't know what you meant. We'd have to figure out what those words.
We know better.
No. What would you say? What was the definition of medium when you were alive?
The strategy by which the world sees. The definition by what the world sees as the medium.
Yeah, that's true. But then you, in this previous call, you brought in human genomes and things. What are you referring to there?
That's how it applies. See, you can know one thing, but once you apply it, it can mean a different thing. Once you apply it. But until you apply it, it matters not. You could go by Walter Cronkite's words as gospel. And you may find out later they're not, but at that moment they are.
Okay, well, I'm ending if nobody's got any other questions.
McLuhan, what did you discover about the ascension process, and where did you discover it?
When he was alive?
Yes, when he was alive.
Well, that it was limited to what the Catholicism provided as a stasis of the process, and that's very limited.
Okay, you start off saying it. It's backwards, but we got to do it again. What did you think the ascension process was when you were alive?
The ascension process was the process that Jesus went through when he became the Son of Man and became the Son of God.
Did you become that? Did you go through that process?
We did. After the fact.
What's after the fact? What fact?
After our transition.
Yeah, when we're talking about when you were alive. And you're saying that you would have written about the limitations of the confessional when you were alive because you perceived it. From what perspective did you perceive
we
the limitations?
We did. We wrote about it voluminously.
Where? And where are those writings?
They are in the carriage house now.
The carriage house. I don't think there's anything there in the carriage house.
Who has access at the carriage house to those writings?
Tom Berenger?
Who'd you say?
Tom Berenger has those writings.
Hey, well, is he in the coach house? Did he leave them there?
No, he took them from there.
Okay.
Is that the actor?
No.
Yeah, okay.
We don't know who Tom Berenger is. I've never heard the name before. He's not someone known to be associated. And they were in the coach house. They're not there now.
Correct.
Because you start off saying they're there, and then we luckily got to this next point. We find out, okay, we don't have to, because they're not there now.
Would those be beneficial to access or pursue?
No, because they're based from a limited position. They're not what he's knowing now, and what he knows now is what we get from Ion.
Good. That's right. That's good conductivity. Good. And that validates the position of the medium as the message as it's unfolding. Good.
Ion validates it? So you said that, you were talking about ion, that's good, and then you said that validates. You mean ion validates the medium as the message?
Do.
Okay. Ion's an environment is what I say.
Good.
And that was Marshall's term when he was alive for medium was the environment.
That's right. And that's what you're questioning right now today. Many moons have passed, but that's still what you're questioning today. Good.
Yeah, in the eternal, like the categorizers, categorizers and scholars would say that's the Platonic level of eternal archetypes, which is the condition that humans are always in and still within the cave and can't see the sun.
So which came first, the itch or the scratch?
Right. So you speak on the Platonic level, but you're also very aware of the sensory dynamics and physical media we're in, and
well,
you now complain. But you're being Platonic when you're saying it always was this blindness.
Correct, because it applies to the now. Because if it doesn't apply to the now, it doesn't apply at all.
No, we agree with that. This is recreational. Just wanted you to talk about what it was you were when you were alive, and if people had some knowledge of McLuhan, they might ask you a few things, like, which daughter did you like the best?
Well, where did Corinne drop off the boat?
Which boat? A boat that the family had?
Yes.
I know. They had a sailboat, and he stopped. Sailing in the early 60s when he got a little more famous and was busy. And so you're saying which family member Corinne dropped the boat off to?
Do.
I'll have to ask Mary.
Good.
Well, which family member did you drop the boat off? Who has your boat now?
Well, that was up to them. That's the point of context, isn't it?
But Corinne dropped it off, you said.
Correct.
And so who did she drop it off to?
You need to ask her.
Well, she's there.
She's not here.
No, she transitioned. She's there. So, Corinne, who did you drop the boat off to?
Not here now.
Okay.
Is there a significance to knowing this?
Beg your pardon?
Is there a significance to knowing this?
Well, I asked the question, which daughter did Marshall like? I'm just trying to do living questions about when he was alive, things we'd be curious about. It's not even significant.
What was your most significant achievement?
Didn't have one.
What was your proudest moment?
No, he said, I didn't have one. That's
didn't
interesting.
Have one.
Oh, okay.
Did you apply
What was your
the,
proudest moment? Or did you have one?
Pride goeth before a fall.
You weren't trying to do that kind of secular achievement.
Never, because that goeth before a fall.
Right, so you were a spiritual activist trying to wake people up or to communicate something.
Or at least present something that they could engage to question the questions. That was
were you successful
point.
At that?
Certainly, you're still talking about us now.
Right, you were successful, but the McLuhan Centenary and the general statements about you in
there
the articles,
not.
It does not matter, and it was not accurate, would you say?
Never.
Because if it was accurate, they describe a guy that was quite irritating and antisocial and things like that. That
well,
don't...
it's not about that. It was the questioning of the questions.
Yeah.
That's what's not been reached even now, even by you, Bob.
You oh, yeah, I've done that. Don't count me. I've
You've
asked
done
more.
More than anybody, and yet the most...
And I came up with the answer. You! Not you, Ion, so, you know, I did a good job.
Well,
that's it. This is McLuhan. Yeah, McLuhan, you're claiming I didn't achieve what you didn't achieve. Well, screw you, buddy, I did.
You've been pissing in the wind for 38 years and trying to figure it out. You may have gotten close to it now, but it's only now, and everything up to now has been just urination.
Well, I agree. Ion really made me more useful to people.
Oh, now that's fair. That's fair. That's fair, because what we were trying to bring up is the landscape that you could touch, embrace, or draw to bring you to your place of now. So
no, you're right. This is Marshall talking, and you're saying the word landscape. That's a very McLuhan Marshall word. That was a key word all through his writings. That's a good word.
You get the de-gutened out of your process,
yeah.
And you'll be all right.
Yeah. But
see, Finnegan's Wake is as important as the Bible.
Angel.
Ask it. Be clear, James. Direct it at him so he can... Come on.
No, he did. Angel.
Come on. Now do it again, James. Angel. Come on. Get into it, James.
I asked, do you see Finnegan's Wake as important as the Bible?
You asked who? It sounded like you said you see.
Yeah, do you, Marshall?
Angel.
Okay. Say, don't... Just be, if Marshall's standing there and you're mumbling, you'd be look stupid. He's standing there. Fucking address him, James, clearly, and address him. Don't be this lazy, stoned out fucker, whatever you're doing. You're fucking being rude. Now, speak to him and make your question clearly.
We'll show
Marshall.
You how to stir a screwdriver, baby.
Yeah. Go ahead, James.
Right.
Come on.
Marshall, do you see Finnegan's Wake as important as the Bible?
Yes.
And Angel, in reference to, I was going to ask, did you apply the, I guess, angelic applications when you were alive? No. Okay.
Okay, James, you're mumbling something. Did he apply angelic? What's that referred to?
Well, in his Christian. No.
Wyndham Lewis was the big battle here. Come on. Suck it up, baby, or take it all, whichever way you want to go with it. Wyndham Lewis, put it in question. Put it in context.
Put what in question, Marshall? Put what in question?
The context of Fit of the Wake.
Right, but he really talked about angels a lot, too. I mean, it's very relevant to bring up Lewis. He talked about the angelization.
That was the original play for cipher that Joyce never knew.
Okay, so, James,
get that
you said
bell.
The word angel. Marshall Mumblethink restated clearly to find out what you're trying to say. And I'm asking you, what the hell were you mumbling about applications? Be clear, James.
No, I was wondering if you had communication with angels.
Certainly.
during his
when?
Time.
When? When? You got to say when.
All the way through, all the way through, a year and 6 months before the Playboy interview, angels from the realms of glory, we most certainly did.
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked that clearly because we didn't get that 5 minutes ago. Well, I don't know what he was saying. But it sounded like you heard a no, James, 5 minutes ago. You asked about application of angels or something, and he said no.
Right.
So what were you saying then, and why does it seem different now without Marshall saying?
Because he qualified it. You pushed the envelope, Bob. He qualified it, and we could answer then. But up until then, we could not.
Ask your questions, James. Don't you want to know more?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, ask them.
I guess, what did you miss out during your time in regards to Finnegan's Wake? What didn't you talk about that you see as valid now?
The outcomes of the Finneganese position.
James Joyce told me through Ion that he did not fully get what Finnegan's Wake was about. Did Marshall get what Finnegan's Wake was about, or Marshall invented, or did he invent his own projection on Finnegan's Wake? Nowhere near what Joyce.
We did not invent. We knew the cipher. We could apply it.
You're saying you, Marshall McLuhan, knew the cipher.
We did.
How did you get the cipher?
It's a long story.
What is the cipher?
Angel.
It's the way to translate Finnegan's Wake. I don't know why he's saying angel. Cipher is a way to understand the code of Finnegan's Wake.
I understand that, but what was the cipher?
Whoa, stop just a second. Jenny Bell, go ahead.
So, Ion, what you were saying is, or is this Ion or McLuhan?
No, McLuhan.
McLuhan.
Okay, so what I understand, Marshall, is that you had a quarrel with Wyndham Lewis.
We did.
And you had.
Well, he was a dumb fuck that didn't know which end was up. So.
And he launched a personal attack on you.
Most certainly.
So, in the analysis of the mind of James Joyce is when he blasted Ulysses.
Well,
no, don't say he. There's too many people there. Why are you bringing in Joyce?
She's right.
Well, what did she say? We don't know what Ginny said. State of the game, Ginny.
Okay.
Just repeat it.
In Time and Western Man.
Yes.
Okay. Wyndham Lewis launched an attack on James Joyce and Marshall.
Not Marshall, on James Joyce.
On James Joyce.
And he blasted Ulysses.
Yep.
Okay. And in that quarrel, that part of it has something to do with this ciphering of the...
There's nothing about the cipher in the quarrel, in that essay. Wyndham Lewis did a satire on Finnegan's Wake a couple of years later in the Chowdermass. And there you had a lot of Finneganese garble.
Right, but the essence of what Jenny Bell's asking about is the answer to the play for cipher.
Well, Jenny wouldn't know what that is. None of us know, because there's nothing about the cipher in Time or Western Man. Now, what's interesting, Jenny, is that Wyndham Lewis attempts to imitate James's early Finnegan's Wake. It wasn't even published yet, but when Lewis was on to Joyce, reading what was published in was called Work in Progress, he attempted something. The best we can get from this is that Wyndham Lewis figured out the cipher and applied it to his imitations of the Wake. Is that what you're saying, Marshall?
No, but he missed it. He missed it.
But you studied Wyndham Lewis, and you got to know Wyndham Lewis, and it's true you guys had a falling out in 1944-45.
Yes, right, because he was full of shit, and he didn't know which end was up.
That's true, and that's even in the biography by Jeffrey Myers. You can read McLuhan's statements on that. But you're saying that Marshall learned about the cipher from Wyndham Lewis.
Yes.
And, Marshall, you learned about the cipher from Wyndham Lewis while you were alive.
Yeah, it was in St. Louis, 1944.
It was at the St. Mark.
I don't know what that is, the St. Mark.
The hotel in St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay, all right.
Room 137.
Okay. Yeah, that's the room might have been caused a problem with Felix. Forget his last name. Yeah, the
very
guy,
good.
His Marshall's professor friend, lent the room to Wyndham, and Wyndham took it over and didn't really do a fair exchange.
That's exactly right. Very good, Bob.
Felix is the very close friend. He's the one who went with McLuhan to meet Lewis. Remember, Marshall's mother tells Marshall where Wyndham is up in Detroit.
That's right. That's very good. Outside of Dearborn, yes.
Right. So what's this about? Okay, so does the angel knowledge come into this cipher analysis?
Oh, we already said that. Ask and answered.
What did you say? Anybody know?
Yes, it does, Bob.
You were talking over McLuhan when he was starting to talk about that.
Yeah.
Isn't that splendiferous?
But, Marshall, could you repeat it?
Well, that angel is the play for cipher regarding Finnegan Ease or Finnegan's Wake.
And Lewis should have known better, or he just had no clue about angels?
He had no fucking clue.
Yeah, because he makes a big deal. He's the one who breaks.
Right.
He comes up with the idea of the discarnate man. He causation of man.
Causation doesn't break the cipher, does it?
And no.
That was the whole problem that Joyce went to his deathbed regarding. He was trying to complete it.
So Joyce had the cipher. He was referring to angels in his cipher?
Joyce did not have a cipher. You know what the hell he was doing? We got the cipher.
You put the cipher into Finnegan's Wake.
We calculated that was the play for cipher in play.
Yeah, but Joyce was not consciously using the play for cipher, is what you're saying
Joyce
right now.
Joyce was not. He wasn't. He didn't have a clue where he was. Let alone.
Okay, so he was quote channeling the writing. You could call it channeling. We hate the word. But there's a kind of unconscious stuff going on in the wake that Joyce is not aware of. Is that what you're saying, Marshall?
Ippity, bibbity, squibbity, Bob.
Yeah.
That'd be,
You're saying that. But Marshall wouldn't speak like that. Marshall, you're saying that language was coming through the wake, and I've discussed this with Ion, language is coming through the wake more than Joyce realizes. An order, and you're saying the key is the cipher, and Marshall figured it out, and did he tell Lewis?
No, he did not.
Did he tell Joyce? Or did he
no, Joyce was dead. He didn't know
Joyce.
Joyce
was stone cold dead.
Yeah.
Okay, so Marshall, when you figured out the play for cipher then, how did that impact your understanding of the wake?
It opened it up and made it conclusively, indictably, clear.
Indictably, that means we could indict the clarity.
Most certainly.
It made it indictably clear. You get people what that means?
No. Why don't you explain it, Bob?
That was your free part, Jenny Bell.
Well, it's a paradox. I don't know what it means. He's saying it made it clear, and that clarity is indictable. Oh, okay, maybe it's what it says. All right, I get it now. Yeah. He told Wyndham Lewis's penis length or something, and a lot of personal stuff about the Queen Mother, and all kinds of things probably in there that would get him a libel. He'd get sued.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what that phrase means, indictably clear.
Very good.
Marshall,
for
did
your
you
have gluten-free society?
Marshall, did you ever write about this?
Never.
Okay.
Did it help you?
No.
Crack the codes of the thunders.
No.
So you just made up
the
surface interpretation. That's the hoax. That's the Mediacology hoax we started with.
Dude.
Your first statement.
Did you apply the place
yes.
of cipher?
Come on, let her
work.
Finish the question. We know you know the answer, Marshall. Like, go ahead,
no.
Barbara.
Say it like air.
I'm just okay. I was asking, did you use the playful
yes.
cipher for any other works?
Yes.
To decipher any other works? I'm sorry, what?
Yes.
Yes.
He did.
Yes, which works?
most of what you'd call free range. The most magnificent works of Edgar Allan Poe.
No, she thinks that you put the cipher in your books.
Well, no, I was asking if he used that cipher to translate
any
other works that he read.
Okay, I didn't.
The most excellent works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Right. And now you had to be a parallel worlder or have awareness on those levels to maybe create a cipher like Edgar Allan Poe was?
Well, time will tell.
Now, you were a parallel worlder, so you were aware of these levels.
Well, relatively speaking, yes. Yeah.
And Lewis and Joyce weren't.
Well, itch comes to scratch or scratch comes to itch, yes.
How did you find out about parallel world traveling?
Itch.
Itch. The itch was there. Okay, you did not study Rosicrucianism, but you heard it discussed around your parents.
It was ridiculous, yes.
But you did say many months ago that that opened up your mind to other perspectives.
It quantitatively made a new veracity to consider.
Yeah.
But veracity to consider doesn't change a meme, does it, Bob?
No. What would you say changed you?
Well, the capacitation of outcomes. See, you're looking at the Android meme, trying to apply it to something. Well, if the Android meme doesn't apply to something, it becomes kind of moot, does it not?
Oh,
yeah.
just as a side thing, the reason I have Hamlet in the Coker quad in my chart is that I have Hamlet in a state of paralysis, a panic paralysis. And yes, Croker does do that. Mm-hmm. That's why all those quadrants are tragedies. The only quadrant that has no tragedy in it, has a good play, is Henry V, and that's my quadrant. So I predicted my own success in relation to the other quadrant.
Of course.
I know that Croker leaves you suspended, but that's just a side thing in that thought.
Right.
What were you just asking about?
But everybody listening already knows you can rule and control the world now.
No, we're not talking about that. I'm just explaining the point of what's the usefulness of Croker, and if you look at my chart, Croker has a different usefulness, but he's useful within this way of getting out of McLuhan's talk. Because we don't want to be platonic and just deal with the same theme, which is what you do. Not you, Ion. It's what Ion does. Not you, Marshall. What Ion does is platonic, quote, is part of its agenda. We don't want to be platonic here. You just become a fanatic. We'll be fanatic. Now, this could move to fanaticism if we have more Ion over the next few weeks till December.
Well, we're not even invited. We've been banished.
Who's we? Who's we? Who's we?
Ion has been banished to the outer ethers.
No. You created a role for yourself of playing the music and the quotes, and that's really good. We like that. We praised you for that for a long time. But we did promise many months ago that maybe Ion would come, that Marshall,
we'll
Ion would bring Marshall through. And you've done that, and I'm happy now we got that done. Now we got that we really rock in the next while.
Well, poor Andrew. We love him.
Oh, yeah. He's ready for it.
We'll miss him.
But the back to this, where were we at, Barbara? What was the topic?
Parallel world traveling.
Right.
How he got started.
We did it voluminously outside of Vancouver. Inside Toronto and then Vancouver, there was like a limitation. But outside of that, there was no limitation.
Who was Prime Minister at the time this happened, of Canada?
Kane.
There was no Kane Prime Minister in the 20th century.
He was.
Not in the 20th century.
Well, look at it again.
So when you were at Cambridge and Gertrude Stein came and spoke there, and Lewis had been criticizing Gertrude Stein, and you had an argument with Gertrude Stein, had you parallel worlded before that argument with Gertrude Stein? So what did you object to what she was saying?
The crucible of Edinburgh. And only you know, Bob, what that means.
And you're saying Gertrude knew about that?
We did, and you know.
You did? Did Gertrude know about it?
No.
So you were bringing it up to her?
No,
I won't go into it, but you were bringing it up to her at the Cambridge theater debate?
That was the argument.
Marshall, could you have meant King, K-I-N-G?
K-I-N-G pronounces Kane.
Okay.
There
yeah.
you go.
And yeah, he was prime minister for a long time, in the 30s
Kang,
and 40s.
Or in the southern vernacular, it would be Kang.
Very good. He was a major prime minister. And what's the dates on him, Carolyn? Yeah. He's like the 30s, 40s, 50s.
We like it better when you say King when it doesn't apply.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you were saying C-A-I-N.
All on the resting soul of Dave Worcester.
No, that's very good, Carol. I'm glad that you picked up on that because I thought you were saying C-A-I-N.
I know. You dismissed.
It's all good.
So what's his dates, Carolyn? When was he?
Well, he looks like he was in there three times
yeah.
in between other people, and it started off in 1921, and his last was up to 1945.
Right. Well, give the stretches. Give the date spans.
If you would like them. 1926 to 1930, 1935 to 1948.
Good stretch there. So that's Marshall. You said 1935, 36? Something
35
like that?
35 to 48.
That would be the time when Marshall would have the experience.
Oh, here's the first one, 21 to 26.
So which administration of the King dynasty era did you have the experience, Marshall?
All of them.
So from the time
you
were 10.
When you world travel.
Yeah,
sorry.
Where'd you go?
When you were parallel world traveling. Was it different times or?
Well, if you've been listening to what Bob the Lion says, there is no time.
Right, but the question was, where did you go?
Yeah, where did you go?
There was no limitation.
What did you experience? What did you see?
All.
And this is not astral projection.
There is no astral projection on this plane.
Right, but this experience you had was not what people think they have when they call it astral projection, where they think
we
they see
know.
All.
We don't know what in the android mean people think when they think.
Right. Well, I'm thinking of people before the android
what?
Meme.
There
what,
is no people
aware?
Before
like,
the android
you,
meme.
Would you say?
Were you aware of your parallel traveling when it occurred?
Most absolutely.
Did it surprise you?
What was the process?
It most certainly did not, and that's why Corinne noted it in her diary.
So you're saying that when this happened, you were with Corinne?
Certainly.
So that's 1938 on.
That's correct.
What process did you go through to achieve
all of them.
Where did you learn the process?
Vancouver the first time, and then New York State.
So, Marshall, when you write in the... what'd you say, Barbara?
I said, what was the process to parallel world travel?
Just that they were available and that you could engage them, and if you did, then you did.
Barbara, here's the interesting thing of what we do know. He writes in the 40s that the artist has to infiltrate, the new kind of artist,
right.
Not the old Gutenberg artist, but the new perceptive spiritual activist, whatever you want to call
social
it.
Social perception. Good.
Social perception catalyst has to infiltrate, quote, decent society. You get a sense of great detachment or
it doesn't apply. Good.
Yeah, he has to infiltrate. So it's from the perspective of what you knew from parallel worlding that you had a sense that, well, I'm going in among the little people here. We'll call it decent society in quotes. Right.
Good.
That's why you were stating things like that.
Well, but you got to realize at that moment that we were still trying to make tenure.
Yeah. That's right. And
Without being curt, you can't get too far outside of the what
yeah,
you
I know, I know. And
mean.
Raise an important point.
Certainly.
Innes dies in 1952. You get tenure in 52, and as soon as you get tenure, you're able to take Innes' knowledge and push it further and make it McLuhan-esque. Could you describe a bit about how you thought about that article or that period in 52?
Well, it's like piss on them.
Yeah, once you had your tenure, you could just, all the gloves were off.
Well, then it made no difference because the validation was no longer necessary
an issue.
To be validated.
Right. So you, so what you wrote in that article, I think it's called Technology and Something and Identity, but that article, no, not Identity.
Technology and Identity.
No, it's not Identity. That's later. That's 1970. This is 1952. In that article, what you wrote, could you have written that article two or three or a few years before?
Certainly.
Right. And you held it in until it was time. What did you learn from your correspondence with Ezra Pound at that period? And you were talking to him about secret societies. What was it you were really interested in?
The interesting is the components that made those realities real.
The components that made the secret societies real.
Correct, because they were not real, but the components made them real if the android meme, as you speak about it, apply.
If it apply, you go, applies? That last
apply.
Word, applies?
Yes, but see, the android meme didn't apply until you came along, Bob.
And then I didn't imply. Or did,
right. Well,
no, wait.
That's
you said the android meme didn't
the
imply? I just want to get the first position. Is something implied or didn't? What did you say?
It didn't apply until you
apply, not imply. Apply.
Apply. That's right.
What didn't apply?
The android meme.
The android meme.
Came along.
And what didn't it apply to?
There wasn't an android meme application until you came along.
Right, right. But what... What was, if there had been, what would it apply to? See, you're saying it didn't apply. Apply to what?
The qualification of the statement at bay.
Well, I don't know what that means. What was going on before me that the application issue is what you're asking or stating about?
The validation of the whole position.
What position?
There was no position. What was being broached at the moment.
And what was being broached at the moment?
Come on, Bob.
No. You give the answer.
At the moment.
You're talking about the secret societies and the components that made them real?
Well, validate the components of the secret
societies. What validated them?
Well, as you would say, the android meme.
That's later. In his time...
What were the components that made the secret societies real?
Well, the questions that came from their validity.
You can work
so
on that part.
They're questioning the validity of what? Like parallel traveling or?
No. That they existed. You got the whole world of skull and crossbones. You got the whole memes that came from those. From that era.
Pound lectured about him on Mussolini's radio. They went on about him. Are you saying they did not exist when Pound and Hitler and John Burton and other people
Correct.
Talked about him in the 20s, 30s?
Correct.
They did not exist.
Correct.
Skull and bones did not exist back then.
Correct.
Then what made them exist? The android meme?
Yes.
Hmm.
But there's a difference between the empires and the secret societies.
Most absolutely.
Right. So
that
really we're talking about the...
That was not known then, but it is known now.
Right. Thanks to us, it's known. But the point is that there were, if you want to call the empire secret societies, but not in the way people wrote about it, like Noah Webster in the 20s wrote about it, and all these other guys.
Merriam Webster, right.
No, not her. Noah Webster, unless that was their pseudonym. The point. I said Noah. I mean Nestor. Nestor Webster.
Yeah,
sorry.
There you go.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Good.
Anyways,
good.
The writings that people read in books about secret societies is nowhere accurate. Now, McLuhan was interested. He read these writings. He asked Pound about it. Did Pound help him? Did Pound understand?
No. Pound didn't have a clue.
So did Marshall find out more about it?
He took the pontification from us and validated his position.
Pound took it from you,
certainly.
Marshall.
Certainly.
So did you make any progress on it, or because?
Hell no.
Right. Because you didn't find out about the empire, so.
Well, it was ridiculous. If you look at the whole position was ridiculous.
He did say to his son occasionally, even in the 70s, well, the Freemasons are doing this and this and that. He was approached by secret societies, he said.
Well, it certainly was we were certainly approached, but they didn't have any validation.
Right. That's why you didn't get involved with them.
Well, of course not. It was, as Ian would say it, it's ridiculous.
Okay, so when you in 51 wrote to Pound and said, I want to needle the somnambulist and distract on the sidelines the triggerman. So distract the triggerman and needle the somnambulist. Can you explain what you meant by those two prongs, project?
Very easily, that you were missing the point. The obfuscated position was that you were missing the point.
The obfuscated position. So whose position is obfuscated and by what?
Well, they're obfuscated by their holistic reality or regalia that said they were valid.
Who were the triggermen?
Gordon Johnston and Preston Capscott.
So they were the triggermen. And what did they do when they were living?
They
at
tried
that time
to validate the Knights Templar and the Knights of Malta.
So he wanted to distract those two guys from what they were doing.
So far, yes.
Because he knew that they would end up in a fool's chase and not get anywhere.
Well, a fool's errand, yes.
Right. And who were the somnambulists you wanted to needle?
That would land it into the Freemasons.
Right. So you're saying that Marshall was,
yes,
his audience for his writings were secret societies, the hoaxing, ridiculous people.
Certainly.
Now, that definitely is about the Wyndham Lewis novel, Apes of God, is about that. So he was a Lewisian. He was carrying on Wyndham Lewis's project on that.
And
in that
what
sense.
We were trying to ease into
softening. Right.
Because otherwise, just get to the real deal, which we know now.
Right.
Applies to the individuals coming to their place of power. But you'd have to talk to Dr. Dean regarding all that.
Right. Now, you said that I set up this Illuminati or the exposure of it and all this stuff in 1911.
No, the Secret Council of Ten.
Right. In 1911, I set up 10 years before this body was apparently born.
That's the first Federal Reserve, yes.
Right. Now, did Marshall manifest himself in 1911, that's when he's supposedly born, because of what I was doing?
Most certainly.
So he was tracking me.
Yes, with Albert Sintrix.
That'd be Sintrix or Tickx?
Sintrix.
Albert Sintrix has been, where is he today?
Happy.
In the guff?
No.
So Marshall was tracking it and tracking what I was doing. So then when he got interested in Wyndham Lewis, met him and then found out the mythology of secret societies, saw
well,
what
were
Lewis did.
Trying to kill somebody, trying to get the cipher, and now you have it.
Right,
so,
right. So Lewis tracked me knowing that I'd put it into the Android meme.
And he was having great travail and fun regarding you roaming around the desert trying to figure it out for 40 damn years.
Well, it was a good trip.
Well, good.
So now we're here at what we really were meant to do, and you're speaking to us.
That c'est la vie or c'est la guerre?
That's life or that's war. Is that what those two phrases mean?
Do.
That's life, that's war. Well, I wouldn't want to be either. It's new.
Oh, okay.
C'est le nouveau.
Good.
Okay, someone else want to take over or we'll end?
I've got a question. It's Chad here, Marshall.
How you doing, Chad?
Oh, number
good,
one.
Bob.
We just love us some number one.
How long you been here, Chad?
10 minutes.
Okay,
I just
so
came on when Marshall was talking about parallel world traveling.
Right.
So I have a question about that. Marshall, did you ever, in your travels, did you ever meet some of the poets and painters that you
admired?
Commented? Yeah, but also to generate your concepts of the artistic awareness. No?
Never. We never gave validity to it.
Never gave what?
Validity to it.
To art.
correct. It was passing. Okay. It was the fancy that had no regalia or regard.
Did you figure out, Marshall, that that non-physical could play in the chip landscape? Did you, were you intuiting that?
Nope.
So you just were noticing this new dimension that the electrified world was creating.
Did you travel to non-electric eras? No.
Well, what was said many weeks ago is that, or maybe to me, was that Marshall saw that the common denominator in different parallel worlds was the printing press.
Yes.
And why? And that struck him as odd. Why is the printing press the same in every world and in every in all these worlds?
Because
what was the insight? Do you want to develop that? What you got from that?
Because it validated the position. Because if it was in the printing press, then it was real. If it was in the news media, the avant-garde media, then it was calculated as a reality.
Okay, it sounded like you were saying if it was in the news media, it wasn't real. In the printing press, it was real, and then you're saying in the electric media, what's the avant-garde media?
Avant-garde means that if it slipped out anywhere in a written form, it was more viable than in any other format.
And you found that was the common thing in all the different worlds, that everybody was hypnotized by the viability of print.
Dude.
So the printing press is the reality maker in every one of these different worlds.
And within those means.
So then you would obviously begin to say, well, the radio is not a printing press, movies are not. Did you get that notion that the newer media were going to change the Gutenberg effect? Did you get that on your own, or did you get it from reading Lewis or Joyce?
That it would replace.
Yeah.
It would replace.
That's what was your unique insight.
Certainly.
That's what no one else got.
Which is what turned Walter Cronkite on his ear.
Right. So did you get where did you get that insight from your? I mean, because you in the parallel world saw the Gutenbergs and the commonality, the hypnosis in those worlds. Then you're looking at the new media in the 20th century. Did you what helped you mull that over? G.K. Chesterton,
no.
Hilaire Belloc, James Joyce
had a bit of effect. Belloc had a bit of effect.
More than Chesterton.
Certainly. Chesterton was a fool.
Well, you met him and were impressed with him in the 30s, but you weren't so impressed in the 40s, in the 70s, in retrospect.
That's right, because it didn't apply. It was.
And Belloc did write about roads and media.
Certainly. And it's valid. It's valid because the positions then were correct. They're not correct now, but they were then.
The positions of Belloc.
Yeah.
He was describing a new perspective.
Era. No, a new era.
New era. So he gets that in, you get that in the 30s.
Yes.
Did you find that no one else was interested in that?
They weren't. Didn't apply.
So did you have the insight about the mediums of message by 1940?
Certainly.
That's what Peter Drucker said. So, Chad, you want to say something?
So, Marshall, you said the printing press was the constant in all those different parallel worlds for forging what people's idea of reality was.
For validation. It was the most.
Validation, yeah. Good word.
Well, we'd call it vindication.
Yeah, vindication, yeah.
Okay, so how did you observe that what were the effects you saw of, like, the White House on the Android meme being the word makes the market in relative to the printing press?
It was the Black House. It wasn't a White House.
what did you say about the White House, Chad? I didn't get your sentence.
Why was it called the Black House?
That's
Black House.
Okay,
no,
Chad,
start
over again. Why the heck did you get on to, what are you saying? Do it again, please.
Okay,
your question?
So Marshall observed the printing press was present in all these different worlds and that it was the vindication of reality. So I asked, what would the effect be of the White House in the Android meme being the word that makes the market? Is it just a Johnny-come-lately trend passing, or Like, where does that stand in relation to all these different worlds?
To the power.
And our answer was, it was not the White House's position. It was the Black House's position.
And what does the word Black House refer to?
The message.
Not 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, you can call the zip code what you want to call it, but
why are you using the word Black House?
Because that's the point that was coming forth.
You mean as in Dark Ages and blackout?
Certainly.
Okay, so you're saying that the power of the White House is more in what they redact than in what they say.
Certainly, that's right. In every State of the Union since Eisenhower, it's been about what they don't say rather than what they do say in the state of the, quote, un-ion.
Yeah, so that's what you mean by Black House. That process. So, but back to that's a result of the electric media.
You'll have to talk to Mary about that.
Who's Mary? Mary McLuhan?
Yeah.
So you got here, you got the print validates. Then you have the electric age, but the White House is built as an institution on the printing rules of the Declaration, so it has to cancel the effect of electric media and pretend it's only a printed world. That's the problem of the White House.
It becomes the word from the Black House rather than the White House.
Right, because they're always going to filter it so it stays within printing press term. Yeah, because all that Joyce and the Vortices or Lewis and Pound wrote about in McLuhan about the effect of electric media, the White House as a literary institution can't handle. And it leaves that problem out.
Go to the hay and you'll figure it out.
I mean, there's...
Or do they just keep everything hidden?
The hay's a hotel, guys, in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say, Barbara?
I said, is it more that they just keep everything hidden?
Yeah, they do not deal with the present electric reality where they have to wing and make up stuff and the word makes the market. They always pretend they're defending literate values that are in the Declaration of Independence.
But not the Constitution.
Yeah. So they black out the fact that the literate values that they represent aren't applied.
Good.
This is Obama's problem.
Aren't we in just a media blackout right now?
No, we're talking about the White House did not talk about the power of electric media in relation to the printing press. That's what they blacked out. That's why, what's the First Lady do? Runs around, tries to improve education, you know, literate stuff. It's a lofty ambition. They don't tell you that that's a silly ambition. That's what they black out. And that's what McLuhan would notice, this aspect.
So, McLuhan, would you call the White House or the Black House a medium in itself?
No.
Would you call it a message?
Never.
You call it a figure?
No.
Would the White House have more of a phase-canceling position?
Neither.
Well, what do you call the White House?
Ridiculous.
Is it a body?
No.
Hugs.
It's ridiculous. That's all. Now, so McLuhan was pointing out how Marshall, point out ridiculousness all over the place, but you couch it in a kind of a nice story about media.
Wow. La guerre.
That's the war part. That was your battle.
Because anymore it's about who's in, who's out, who's up, who's down, who's beyond, who's behind. None.
What did you like to do when you weren't in class, weren't visible too much to people? What activity did you do?
Read,
yeah. Anything about Witchwood Park, that house, did you leave a residue there that the new occupants who redesigned the place might experience?
Yes, in the plumbing.
What did you do with it?
Well, it never worked since.
Did you fix it?
No.
So they're going to have problems with the plumbing.
They always have, yeah.
Yeah, they just remodeled it a year or two ago. New people bought it.
And it doesn't work. Yeah.
Okay, we could get validation. Chad, get on that and call them up. The new owner, go visit them. And this is what Marsh used to do to me. He used to give me a project. And why did you want me to go look up the oral tradition in Stratford in England?
You actually could get to the Stratford on Avon, so you could actually get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, if I'd gone there, we wouldn't have waited 40 years for Ion.
That's exactly right. You would not have, and you would have gotten the whole point.
Yeah, and he told me that. That was very pointed. Bob, you're going to have to do this. And, of course,
not.
I didn't. Or not. Yeah. Yeah.
You choose.
But that's where we converged on the secret level of the 1911 project.
Bum, bum, bum.
Wait, can you repeat that? What he told you where to go, Bob?
He told me to go where Shakespeare grew up, Stratford-on-Avon.
Stratford-on-Avon.
And he said the families there in that town, there's the relatives of people who knew Shakespeare, 400 years ago, were still there. And you could go and talk to them. It was called the oral tradition. And you go talk to them about Shakespeare, and maybe there'd be some family secrets. Maybe there was even a residue of empires there, or, quote, secret societies. So I would go and talk to these people, and McLuhan thought if I did it, I would evoke all kinds of interesting information.
Okay, but you never
was
did
that
it?
Address?
No.
Witchwood?
3 Witchwood Park is in Toronto near St. Clair and Bathurst. That's where...
W-I-T-C-H?
No, W-Y-C-H.
Okay.
3 Witchwood is the address. And you can look up, there's an article was published within the last year, showed the new redesigned house and that. But the, that was on. That was April 20th, 19...
back to Anne Hathaway.
Ah-ha! Now, does that get into the Mary Queen of Scots and Protestant battles?
No, now just don't.
Oh, we can't go there. Okay. All right.
Well, you can, but don't get a big erection over that. But
Anne Hathaway knew some of the what was going on.
That was William Shakespeare's wife.
Right, but so there's lots of sonnets and stuff. She's a mystery figure, what I last heard, which is 50 years ago. I've been following her.
Stratford on Avon was the wonderful house that they enjoyed together.
Right, but the point is she taught him a lot, is what you're getting at.
Well, yeah, but that's not the – well, it is the point. But.
Right, so the –
So there was no anonymous. William Shakespeare did write all of those works.
Well, certainly.
There's a new movie out about that.
Well, LaRouche would say that Shakespeare was from the position of a Catholic, and as the Protestants locked it down after Queen Elizabeth, he got depressed. Were some of his plays about the tragedy of England as his religious community did not do well? In power, was that a factor in his plays? What he was talking about, Marshall? Well, wait a minute. That's Ion question. Sorry, we got mixed up here. Well, here's what I good. I remember what I was going to say.
We were holding the girdle, Myrtle, to get on Mabel. That
$2
was for beer.
What I was going to ask was, it was on April 20th, 1979, Hitler's birthday, that you gave me that project. I remember that. It was that day. It was his birthday. And then I gave you the Ezra Pound book, and you went to page 69, like you always did, to see what that page said. What were you finding out? Why did you pick page 69, that number 69? What more about that we don't know?
It was good as any. If you look at it, you'd know.
Well, it looks like the yin-yang, but there are other aspects there?
Well, look at it.
Okay, so that was part of your parallel world knowledge? Is that knowledge had you look at 69?
Dude.
Looks like two spirals, like, counter-opposed.
Yeah. So, Marshall, what you taught in school, which was first Pound, Joyce, Eliot, and these people, and then more media, but always bringing them into it, were you really talking about something else to the students, and that was more of a cover story?
Well, describe cover story.
Well, the media were a metaphor for what you were really interested in.
Well, the outcome.
Hmm. What would be the outcome? Madame Blavatsky outcome? Enlightenment. Global enlightenment?
Well, global is a great big word.
So you were like, today or best 40 years, you got people who become cults, gurus, and they offer spiritual knowledge that isn't recognized in academia. You were like that kind of knowledge infiltrating academia. You had another agenda to the students that could receive it.
Well, a more complete outcome, not an agenda.
Yeah. All right, an outcome.
Were you pursuing ascension?
No.
Did you know about Jiddu Krishnamurti? Yes. Your comments on Jiddu Krishnamurti's teachings?
We already said yes.
No, you knew about them. He's asking you, could you comment on his teachings?
What you want to know?
Okay, comment on Jiddu Krishnamurti's method of delivery when sitting in front of a crowd and addressing them.
Well, you don't want to be disingenuous, but it wasn't very, the proffer was not very supportive.
That's right. That's what I said in my essay on you, that you bypassed Krishnamurti's methods and had more up-to-date stuff to do.
Then that and 50 cents will get you coffee at Waffle House.
Right. Thank you very much, Marshall, for showing up.
Hold on.
Thank you.
Hold on. Stratford-on-Avon. To breathe of life, Anne Hathaway. Shakespeare's wife, yes.
Is that a phrase or a line you're quoting?
Yes.
Or making a pun out of her name?
A point. Anne Hathaway. Hath-a-way.
Right. Anne Hathaway.
That
yeah. We were talking, I was talking to Margarita yesterday about Twin Peaks and how Dale Cooper gets taken over by Bob at the end after they murdered his girlfriend, Anne. He's going, Annie. So that totally resonates with today's message.
Most certainly.
Anne Hathaway. Okay, very good. We have to go now. We hope you can come back next time, anytime. Don't worry about Andrew.
Oh, good. It matters not.
Yeah, no, I think you perform very well, Marshall. We get what you're about. Maybe we can get into a now. Next time, how you would explain, enhance the ion effect.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
C'est la guerre.
Or c'est la vie.
Yeah. C'est la nouveau. What was it?
To melt the sad, make blithe the day. To charm all hearts, Anne Hathaway. She hath a way, Anne Hathaway. To breathe the light, Anne Hathaway.
Are you? Is this Marsh McLuhan quoting Shakespeare?
Dude.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's Marshall quoting Shakespeare. Did you know of that poem when you were alive, or you found it now?
Now.
Right. Okay, well, we are happily, totally, completely incomplete.
Incomplete.
Very good. Very good, JW. Maybe there's going to be no JW.
Is it Ion? Or Ion's gone, too?
Yeah, he gone, Ion went. You heard the exhale.
Yeah, okay.
So, Bob, my definition of c'est la guerre, what you were saying, is...
Well, he says it all the time. I don't know what it means. I guess that's war, that's life, c'est la guerre, c'est la vie. I don't know. Some kind of cliche I never
guerre,
looked at.
Yeah, my knowing of that phrase is it means waiting for the arrival of a departure or a pending event.
Yeah, I don't know.
Long live the war.
Long live the war. Is that JW speaking?
We're not sure. C'est la vie is live and let live. C'est la guerre is long live the war.
Well, thanks for coming by, everybody.
So what's the phrase that means waiting for
We're ending, Tina. Tina, it's over.
Yeah.
It's over.
Hey, Bob, are you going to call me? Or?
Yes.
You said you wanted? Okay.
Yep. I'll call you.
Okay.
Just
all right. Well, good night, everyone. It was fabulous.
Yeah, thanks for your contributions, Barbara. Very good.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
Or call me. All right, bye.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks. Talk to you later.
Right.
Bye.
Bye, Tina.